this episode, Once Upon a Blue Devil, issue number 2. And welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we're finding our joy as we continue our coverage of one of my all-time favorite comic book characters and comic book series, really, Blue Devil. Today, we're specifically covering Blue Devil issue number 2 from 1984. Now, my name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I am your host, but I'm not doing this alone, folks. Once again, I am joined by my own personal weirdness magnet, Mr. Diablo Frank. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, it's the Irrepressible Frank. How you doing? I'm fine. I'm talking Blue Devil for the first time in 6 months, which I guess is somewhat thematically correct.
Well, I mean, hey, the promise is that I'm going to try and get 3 episodes a year out of Blue Devil stuff. So we managed to get 3 out last year. It's only March, so we're going to get one out this month. And yeah, we should be all on target to make this happen.
All I know is right now we're in competition with Hero Points, and I'd really like to get ahead of them.
I think we're already surpassed them. Thank you very much. And that is such a deep cut that only like 4 people listening even understood what that meant. So thank you very much for that, Frank.
Well, we are in year 9 of the podcast, sort of, kind of. So I don't know that your math is adding up.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, so I feel like I am setting a bit of a precedent here because, you know, last month I did Daredevil. Now I'm doing Blue Devil. Maybe I have like an obsession with devils. I don't know. Hellboy next month. I have no idea.
Well, and it's not just you, because I was already planning my 60th anniversary Daredevil podcast with my guys, and I came out a few days after you, so we're clearly on some kind of wavelength when it comes to the Infernal, at least.
Well, it terrifies me to think that even for 1 second that you and I are on a similar wavelength, and it has of the Infernal variety, so that's just not good. That's not
Look,
good.
You've been irredeemable for a long time. There are consequences.
I have been referred to as the Diet Coke of evil. I'm not as irredeemable as I wish I could be. I used to be much more irredeemable, but I've grown old and soft. So this is our 4th episode diving into Blue Devil. We've covered the 16-page preview from Fury of Firestar number 24. Had an interview with Dan Mishkin and Gary Cohn, which we replayed, and then we did our coverage of Blue Devil number 1, so we're continuing on with issue number 2. Now, Frank, this time I have got my tablet here with me. I am looking at, you know, the DC Infinite version of Blue Devil, and I've got the physical comic available, but next time we do this, Frank, I should have in my hot hands my bound editions of Blue Devil. I sent them off a while ago. I've been working with the guy doing the binding. He just sent me the covers to sign off on. I am getting 3 volumes put together of all the original 31 issues of Blue Devil, plus the annual, plus the Who's Who pages, plus the DC sampler, plus the 6 issues in Showcase that Mishkin and Cohn wrote. So it's all going to be bound together in 3 volumes, and it's going to look amazing. I'm so excited.
How long after the credit card charge clears do you think it's going to be in DC solicitations for the Blue Devil Omnibus Official Edition?
Well, I paid for it up front, so it should have already happened by now. But sure. I figure it'll more likely be like the day I get it will be the day that they drop the solicitation is what will happen.
Well, I'm free of boxes. I feel like, what is it, Kramer? You know, levels, Jerry, levels. I don't have any comic book boxes that I use anymore except for stuff I'm going to get rid of in the future. They're my trash box now. All my stuff's on shelves. It was so great to walk to the top shelf, have all my DC stuff, and just pull my Blue Devil number 2 out like I was pulling an LP in like high fidelity or something.
You've shared some pictures in our groups of your collection and the way it's organized, and it's just sickeningly gorgeous. I mean, I already hate you. I mean, I have for years, but I hate you even more to see how incredibly well organized it is. And being that I've been in your house, whether when you were inviting me in or the times I snuck in while you were asleep, I already know what you had to work with, and I'm just even more impressed with what you've made come together, and wow, man.
Living the dream. When I was a kid, my uncle took me to a friend of his house, and he had shelves with LPs and comic books and magazines. And it's like, that's going to be me when I grow up, and I'm finally grown. It only took half a century, but I'm finally that grown.
In the 1980s, you invented the term life goals. I'm impressed. All right. All right. Well, before we get too much further, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic book trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a comic book collected edition to briefly discuss from the In Stock Trades library, and usually it's tied into our discussion some way, shape, or form. I picked, and I'm super excited about this. I thought, okay, Blue Devil, I'm always saying it's fun. That's their tagline, making comics fun again, all of it. So what's fun? And I found the, I guess it's a replica, kind of, sort of the Marvel Big Book of Fun and Games. And this is a collection, 144-page collection, that features tons of kids' games like puzzles and connect the dots and drawing tutorials and trivia and word searches and maze and all this fun stuff from Marvel's Fun and Games magazine. And I guess a lot of these used to appear in Marvel Comics, and then they collected them all in these books. I don't know exactly the origins of all of it, but it's all classic Bronze Age style stuff. I had one of these growing up. It's still somewhere in this house. It wasn't this exact edition, but it's very similar. And these books provided me with, I mean, literally countless and endless number of hours of joy of either doing the puzzles or just flipping through it or coloring it or whatever. So this one is, again, 144 pages. It is a reproduction of old original puzzles, full color, soft cover. Normally goes for $14.99, but you can get it 25% off right now, so it's only $11.24. And this is amazing and perfect for a Marvel fan, whether you're young or old. It is a hell of a lot of fun. Did you ever see these books growing up? Do you know what I'm talking about?
This was a periodical, right? They had a monthly book that ran for about 15 issues or so.
Well, I don't. The one I had was a big, thick, what we call perfect bound, right? Like, it was like the 144 pages. It was a big, thick book just like this. There may have been a smaller periodical that was published, but mine was a big, old, thick, you know, bound thing.
Yeah, what I had, I believe it was called Marvel's Fun and Games. It was a comic book sized edition, and it just had things like connect the dots and match games and things like that. And so I only had the one that I picked up off the newsstand. And so if it's that, then I'm familiar with it. I think I saw the solicitation. I basically like, dude, you're never going to play the Fun and Games. Stop it. You don't need to have all the things you had in your childhood. But I did contemplate this one.
Thanks for your uplifting vote of confidence, sir. What did you bring to the party, Frank?
The plan was to break into your house and check out your copy along with your perfect bound Blue Devil hardcover omnibus that DC Comics proper is denying me. I brought Captara Trade Paperback Volume 1, Fear Not Tiny Alien. I'll read the copy. Holy cow, the cheapest image trade yet at $9.98. That's Chip Cheap, Keith Kaniga, Crash Lands on Captara, a world filled with danger and weird danger and dangerous weirdos. And if he can't survive, then Earth, the place where you live, is doomed. Come check out this sci-fi comedy from Chip Zdarsky of Daredevil, again, keeping up the theme, and Kagan McLeod of Infinite Kung Fu that everyone is calling published. Collects Captara 1 through 5, 128 pages, was $9.98, list price $5.78. You save 42%. So you can get multiple Captaras for your Marvel Fun and Games. The reason why I bring this one up is because this book came out, I think, in 2015, and only just now did they solicit the second and final edition of Captara. So I'm thinking, well, if I might want to get that second one since I've had the first one on my shelf for a long time now. Reading it, I was surprised to find that what it really is, covertly, is it's a Masters of the Universe comic. These people basically crash land on Eternia as Skeletor and Evil Lyn are plotting some stuff, and they run into all these different people, and essentially it's a parody, because obviously they're not the real people, but it's really obvious who they're parodying. And it's definitely got some foul language in it, it's definitely got some political themes in it. Only about half of the audience is going to appreciate some of the jokes they make in this book, but if you like Masters of the Universe, and this flew under your radar, and certainly Chip Zdarsky's profile has gotten a lot bigger since 2015, you might ought to check this one out, especially at $6. It's kind of hard to lose, unless you're of a very particular political stripe, in which case you can definitely lose buying this book. But I wanted to promote it mostly because it was fun, and it felt like the kind of thing that somebody who likes Blue Devil would like.
It does sound fun. Like, I still don't even know what the book's really about, other than what you just, you know, about the attorney stuff, but just the solicitation alone is so much fun. Like, I would pick that up just on a whim to go, okay, I'll try this, because they know their target audience, you know, to make this fun. So it sounds fantastic. Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally, it's the setup of Planet of the Apes, but they let crash land on Eternia instead, essentially.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, that sounds awesome, and I think I'm going to have to check that out. So folks, for these and all your other comic book trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows, you know, requires a lot of online hosting and other other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the shows on the network, such as this one, the best way to support us is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast, and consider supporting the network while you're there. And in certain tiers, you get mentioned on your favorite shows. This episode's special thanks go to Gord Tolton, David Ace Gutierrez, whom I actually sat down with recently and had breakfast with in LA, Michael Salko, who I also got to meet face-to-face in LA, which was awesome, met him for the first time, and sadly, some weirdo named Diablo Frank, who, unfortunately, I'm talking to right now. Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcasts.
Well, what's funny is technically I'm a Patreon of Siskoid's Who's Editing podcast, which is on an indefinite hiatus. And he keeps swearing up and down that it's going to come back at some point. But then literally on the last episode, he's like, oh, but Frank, you may want to move your patronage somewhere else. I was like, geez, showing me the door much is Siskoid. So I haven't decided on who's going to get my, you know, Patreon support. But I guess this show's as good as any.
Well, any show you're on with me, I'm going to say you're supported. It's so tough.
Sure, sure.
With your time and effort, if nothing else. So
I know I'm a promotion tool. I'm part of your pack. I get it.
So with that incredibly smooth transition, folks, get out on the social media and please talk about Blue Devil. Talk about issue number 2, because remember, we are here to represent our entire geeky community and celebrate all the things we love. So we want to hear your thoughts. Share your opinion on everybody's favorite weirdness magnet, Blue Devil. The best way to be part of the conversation is the comment section on our website. So you just go out there and visit firewaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. Share your thoughts there on the show post, and we will read those on the next episode where we cover Blue Devil. Just like when we're done talking about Blue Devil number 2, Frank and I are going to read your feedback from Blue Devil number 1 that was left on our website. Also, I'll run the regular socials. You can find us on Twitter and Blue Sky as Once Upon a Geek Podcast, and on Facebook and Instagram, you can find us as Once Upon a Geek Podcast. All right, here we go. I'm so excited. We are finally doing this. We are going to talk about Blue Devil number 2, published by DC Comics, cover dated July 1984, on the shelves April 26th, 1984, cover price 75 cents, 3 shiny quarters, with a cover by Paris Collins. You want to describe it for us?
Yes, it announces in the copy, Shockwave, he likes to break things. And if you happen to have the corner box that came from the direct market, the new DC, there's no stopping us now. Still, I think, one of DC's best mottos, and certainly in a time period where I was much more receptive to it than I might be in the current days. As far as the cover itself, it's basically an action shot. You've got Shockwave knocking down a building, maybe a notable building, but we'll find out in the story. And meanwhile, a Blue Devil is coming at him with a trident that he doesn't, unfortunately, currently have in his possession in the story, but it looks really cool on the cover. And I have to point out that as best as I can tell, this is inked by Paris Collins as well as drawn. Mm-hmm. And he does have a nice ink line. There was some copy from, I think, editor Alan Gold, where he's talking about how Collins wasn't at a place where he'd ink his own stuff yet as much as he'd wanted to. But certainly this cover doesn't give any indication that he's not able of inking his own stuff. It might have just been a time issue. It looks great to me. And I think that there is a little bit of a Prez-like richness in the blacks on this cover, that and there's no lack of detail. So it's really fantastic. Like, the windows are shattering, the bricks are breaking. There's tons of stuff to look at on this cover.
Yeah, it really looks fantastic. I mean, in fact, if someone told me that, like, Dick Giordano or somebody inked this over Paris, I'd believe them. It looks that clean and that focused. And so if Paris did this himself, man, hats off. Well done. Looks really, really good. I love things like that. Like you mentioned, the building that Shockwave's holding up or pulling down, whatever you want to look at. I mean, it really looks like that building is falling towards the reader. Like, it's going to fall on our head. I love that. The layout of it really did a good job with that. I also really like Shockwave's color scheme, you know, the red and the white. There's so much white on the costume. You don't see that kind of a costume very often with that much white and with red highlights. So it just works really well. Now, there's one mistake on there. You mentioned the trident already, but Shockwave's actually missing his chest insignia, which is like a seismograph wave line. So they somehow got missed on the cover. And I wonder, a lot of times covers are done months in advance, you know, for solicitations and whatnot. And it's possible that this cover was done before Shockwave's design was finalized and before they decided that the trident being missing was going to be a plot point. I mean, that is a possibility.
Well, I mean, it just so happens that there's an advertisement for this comic book in the comic book. So that's a pretty decent suspicion that you've got working for him there.
Yeah, it could be. What else? So there's something sort of I've been struggling to describe for years. I have said on many different podcasts that there is an era in DC Comics and Marvel to some extent, too, where the covers of issues number 2 just really sing to me. Like, this cover here sings to me. I just absolutely love this. I love the way Blue Devil looks. I love his face. He doesn't look cartoony at all. He looks extremely action-oriented. Like you said, the angle of the trident, the whole thing is just the whole composition of the cover is fantastic. And I sat down and tried to figure out what it is that I love about issue number twos. And I think I've finally got a finger on it now. And what it is like issue number one covers typically are like the poster shot, right? Like Blue Devil number one was very much a movie poster shot, or, you know, some of the other comics from DC in the 80s, then issue number one is the, hey, you know, kid, buy this off the shelf kind of grab you shot. Whereas issue number two often is mid action. And I went and looked for some examples. I'm not going to go too deep in there. I'll just rattle them off. But like New Teen Titans number two, you know, that's the one where Terminator and was it Ravager are dealing with all the knockdown Titans. You know, it's a moment in time. It's captured. Crisis number two, they're fighting a bunch of shadow demons. Batman and the Outsiders, they're at the mercy of, was it Dr. Bedlam or whatever his name is?
Baron
Bedlam, yep. Green Arrow number two, he's at the mercy of Vertigo. The America versus Justice Society, the Spectre's yelling in the court, you know, release the Justice Society or die. So commends the Spectre. And then V number two, which is one of my favorite covers, has a visitor and he's holding a little kid with a gun to his head. And he's saying, like, humans, don't even think it. So it's the number twos that just feature an action shot. It just sing to me, and this is one that I absolutely love. I think it's one of the best ones, and I don't know whether Ed Hannigan did the layout, because back then he was doing a lot of layout design work for DC on covers. I don't know whether he did it or Parrish did it himself, but it's a really well-structured cover.
Yeah, the particular examples you're giving are hit and miss for me. I will have to agree with you, though, that New Teen Titans number two was such a striking cover. You have such a cool-looking villain, and it's not even the real villain. You know, that
right.
Part of what's so great is you got this guy that looks neat, and there's a guy even neater in silhouette behind him. It's like, oh, wait, this guy is going to be played by somebody even more cool. Man, how great is that going to be? I got to open this comic book and see what's going on in here. But yeah, I agree with you. You've got you're selling the concept with that first cover.
Yep.
You start to sell a story with the second cover, and it's something I really miss in modern comics, because so many modern covers are just pinups and they don't reflect the interiors of the book. And if you're a comic book reader, part of why you buy it is because you love stories. Give me a hook, give me an angle, give me something novel that'll make you want to crack that cover instead of just admiring it and putting it back on the shelf. And I think it's a lost art form, and I think in the 80s in particular, especially as DC is just trying their level best to claw back some of that market share from Marvel after being just dominated in the 70s, you're seeing that effort here. That look, we may not be able to hire the biggest names, although for God's sake, they had George Perez. That ain't nothing to sneeze at. They got Joy Ordway. You know, you could definitely do a lot worse than that kind of lineup. But they had to really announce themselves. Look, you need to read our comic books. You can't just buy X-Men all the time. Try something else, please. Look, we got some cool stories to tell you.
No, that's a good summation. And I would say around 82, 83 is when it starts to make the turn. And then eventually it'll reach the pinnacle, which is 1987. The single greatest publishing year of comic books ever, but that's just my
87.
Yeah,
I think that there would be a little dispute on that. I think 86 might be the year that most people lean towards, but I think you might have something with its thumb on your scale. You know, there might be some particular title that's doing that, leaning you in that particular direction.
If you mean Suicide Squad, that's not the one I'm thinking of.
Nope, definitely not that one.
So you mentioned already there's an ad, so let's talk about that real briefly. So there is a house ad that features a promotion for All Star Squadron number 35 and Blue Devil number two, because those comics go together logically. I guess the only real connective tissue was they're both on sale April 26th. So they've got this house ad. So, you know, the first under All Star Squadron, the first All Star dies, and it talks about that. And you got, what is that, Baron Blitzkrieg versus Our Man on the cover. But then you get the issue number two cover, exactly like you just described. It's that cover are there. And it says, a supervillain he can call his own, by Gary Cohn, Dan Mishkin, Paris Collins, and Gary Martin. I'm glad the inker got mentioned. He's trapped in a suit of his own making, and now comes Shockwave to make it even worse. So they were really, you know, going all out to try and get the word about Blue Devil at the time, and that's fantastic.
Well, one thing I liked about DC Comics is that they really tried to sell the book of the month.
Mm.
Marvel would often have like an iconic figure of like, look, here's a Daredevil. Why don't you read a Daredevil comic sometime or something like that? Where one of the things that I loved about the DC Comics that I got my hands on as a kid was it wasn't just by Legion comic. It's by Tales of the Legion number 362 or whatever it was, because it has this particular story in it. And I don't know about you, a lot of those house ads, I fixated on those books, because mm-hmm. I felt like if they were going to spotlight that one particular comic book, there might be something really special about that one. I'm going to look for that one. I'm going to seek that one out.
There's a lot of comics that I have an overinflated sense of importance because of a house ad. Like I thought, you know, I'd see a house ad for, you know, whatever that Omega Man issue was with all the orange bodies connected. I can't even describe it. Anyway, like that issue in my head, it must be important.
Oh, the Tigra or Tigra is the guy's.
But it's like a repeated image all over. Yeah. But like that issue must be important because there was a house ad. I remember it, you know, but like it's probably not. But it's embedded in the ferment of our brains because we saw it so much.
Yeah. there's no such thing as an important issue of Omega Man. There's some valuable issues, but not important issues. Not reader important issues.
Right. No, that's very true. All right, let's get on the inside of this thing. So it is written by Dan Mishkin and Gary Cohn. Penciler is Paris Collins, and all three of them together are listed as co-creators. Inker is Gary Martin. Woohoo! Gary is on the scene and will make a difference on the book. Letters Todd Klein. Colors is Michelle Wolfman. Editor is Alan Gold. The issue itself is called Get Me Out of Here, and I'm going to read a recap real quick. It's a little longer than last time, but we'll get through it. There's a lot of stuff happens. So at night in Metropolis within Star Labs, a new armored supervillain calling himself Shockwave breaks in, heading towards Section 13, the Radiation Lab. The next day, Blue Devil's on the streets of Metropolis, crowded by onlookers and a news crew. They're peppering him with questions, asking if he's there to promote the new Blue Devil film. Danny's flustered, and he escapes by leaping over the rooftops and then breaking up a mugging, saving the day. Danny continues to wander, and we're treated to flashbacks where we see a medical specialist tell Danny that the Blue Devil costume has become organic material and bonded to his skin. It isn't a costume anymore. It is him. Back in the present day, Blue Devil returns to the brownstone apartment building where he lives. Marlo Bloom calls, telling Danny that Jock Werner, who is the CEO of Werner Brothers Studios and the producers of the Blue Devil movie, Jock Werner's upset that Danny's out there making appearances in public in the Blue Devil suit. And about the same time, this ongoing police standoff with Shockwave quickly reaches outside of his brownstone. Shockwave demolishes Danny's brownstone, and our hero emerges from the rubble. Now, thinking that Blue Devil's a hero, Shockwave attacks, but only maddens Blue Devil into fighting back. Blue Devil knocks Shockwave into a nearby park where the fight continues. Then Dr. Jeanette Clyburn arrives and tells Blue Devil that Shockwave stole some concentrated super kryptonite from Star Labs that they've been developing for testing purposes, in quotes, wink, wink. Blue Devil realizes that he must get it back before he can be used against Superman. Meanwhile, Jock Werner is even more upset about Blue Devil's televised battle with Shockwave because it's disrupting his promotional strategy for the upcoming movie. He orders Marla Bloom to stop these unauthorized appearances, and Marla begrudgingly calls her attorney. Now, Blue Devil and Shockwave, their battle continues in the park until a strange flying craft arrives, manned by a shadowy supervillain and several henchmen. The craft's tractor beam pulls Shockwave aloft, but Blue Devil leaps and snatches the canister which holds the super kryptonite. Shockwave and the villain's flying craft retreats rather than stay to battle the approaching police, but Blue Devil has saved the day. In appreciation, Dr. Jeanette Clyburn and Star Labs offers to repay Blue Devil by scientifically examining his suit to see if it can be removed. Just then, an attorney arrives, barring Blue Devil from using the exosuit in public, which is, of course, the property of Marla Bloom Associates and Werner Brothers Films. Blue Devil picks up the attorney by his jacket and hangs him from a light post. Blue Devil then leaves with Dr. Clyburn. Now, the attorney is dangling from the light post, and he is outraged and threatens to sue Blue Devil, but the remaining TV crew and police officers claim not to have seen what happened to the attorney, wink, wink, because, boy, they are thankful to Blue Devil for saving everyone and the astonishing footage that they recorded. The police ask the lawyer, "You sure it wasn't Shockwave that put you up there?" So, laughs ensue. Next issue, the action continues as the bounding Blue Devil squares off against Metallo. Oof, all right. So that's a lot going on there, buddy. What's going on? What do you think of this issue?
So I don't know about getting into what I think about this issue just yet, because that's going to be a whole discussion.
Okay.
Of that. What I want to say is that I like Pablo Marcos. He's a solid enough inker. I've enjoyed him on stuff. But I think Gary Martin is just one of the best inkers in comics history and one of the most unsung. If you look at some of his cover recreations that he does these days, they're just outstanding. They're fantastic. They're so extraordinary. And as much as I like Collins's work in the previous material, it just comes to a new level with this issue.
It really
does. The detailing is so fantastic. The inks are so rich. The faces are just so perfect. One thing I like, we always talk about guys like Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Praise be his name. We talk about, you know, George Perez, you know, rest in peace, rest in power, you know, George Perez.
Oh, yeah.
These are the guys who made, like, the most iconic, the versions of the characters that you picture in your mind and your dreams, the closest to, like, the platonic idea of our comic book characters. And I think there are a few other people that do a really good job of that sort of thing that aren't as sung. I think that Chuck Patton was really getting to that level in this time period. period. I wish that he'd gotten to continue to do the iconic Justice League. As much as I like Detroit, I think that this is a guy who was supposed to be doing Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, those type of characters. And I especially when you have an inker like Dick Giordano, you look at some of those covers that they did together. Oh my God, that's again what Justice League should be.
Yeah.
And another guy at Marvel that was somewhat like that was Cary Gamble. They don't talk about him very much because he wasn't very prolific. But I don't know. He's like one of my favorite Captain America artists of all time. He's only drawn him in a few comic books, but it's just like that's who I picture when I picture Captain America. And I think that Cullen's here with the help of Gary Martin is getting close to that level, and they're just getting started on this book. But in a few issues, we're going to see them do Justice League characters, and those are some of the more iconic versions of the characters. Those are like in my childhood, those were what the Justice League should be. And Cullen's another guy who doesn't get talked about very often, and I do love his stuff, but with him and Martin together, it's just such an extraordinary combination that this book just like, again, it's just kicked up another speed. It was already doing well. And then you just look at it as like, okay, this is something. There's a reason why we're still talking about this book 40 years later.
Gary Martin, I don't know enough about art to speak about this with artistic intelligence, so forgive me, but he understands the width a line needs to be to work. Whether it's something as simple as like page 5, the cameraman, where the camera could have just used a super thin line, but he didn't. He used a thicker line to outline the camera, and it just pops, and it works. It makes sense. The video, the pinball machine with the Nebros drawing, the lines on the Nebros character stand out because they want your eye to go there. So those lines are thicker than the rest of them. I mean, he knows exactly the thickness of the line to use, and it's gorgeous. He really does elevate the book. And you're right, Cullen's and Martin together are a powerhouse creative team and are just going to get better and better. And I'm so glad that he's on this Blue Devil book. And I think it's probably a big part of why I love it so much.
Yeah, and what's great too is Martin adapts his style to the artist. And so what he's done is he's seen what Cullen's strengths are. He's big, he's broad, he's in your face, you know? And so he adapts to that. And one thing I dig is that there's a lot of really fine details here. Like Cullen's is a cartoony artist, so it'd be easier to just have big, you know, cartoony characters. But then he'll go in there, like on this very first page, there's an upturned desk. You could cheat that so easily. You could throw a shadow over that. And what he's done instead, and maybe a rookie mistake. I mean, this is a young guy, he's an enthusiastic guy. He's maybe putting too much effort into this desk, but he's drawn every cord and every little like stationary thing and you know, the Rolodex and like everything is in here. Above that, you see shattered glass. And again, it could just be a few, you know, odd rectangles or something, but instead they've drawn every little crack in the glass. It reminds me of Jeff Darrow, where you'll have like this big open area and then this tight concentration of detail, and it's thick, it's inky, it's like it's drawing your eye to it because they want you to know, hey, see this part right here? I really put a lot of work into this. I want you to pay attention to this, and you can't miss it. It reminds me also a lot of the Japanese artists, where you'll have like the big broad characters in the foreground, and the backgrounds will be like just super realistic detailing. This is more like Darrow though, where it's just like it's letting you know you're in a fantastic world. It's going into a lot of detail. It's grounding, but also it's like too much detail. Like your eye can't see that much detail. It's like watching a movie in HD or something, where it's more real than real, which is perfect for this kind of comic book, which is such a big fantastical book, where you've got that mix of, look, we're doing technology, but we also got demons running around, and just get into our wavelength. It lets you know it's a certain kind of comic book and you need to come at it with a certain mentality.
The Jeff Darrow comparison is interesting. Darrow's too much for the eye, I think. I think that here they've got the perfect balance, though. I see what you mean about a level of detail. I think this is an easier to follow balance because it's almost like each panel has just one thing they want you to focus on rather than everything. And that's what I love. Like that shattered door you mentioned with the glass, like, again, he knew the thickness of the line to use on the shatter pattern, or the glass was missing, but then the rest of the cracks are thin. Or the desk, the edges are thick lines, but the interior lines are all thin. I mean, he just knew exactly what he's doing and where to draw the eye. And that says a lot about an artist.
Yeah. Well, and then the next panel, you got that monitor bank where you're so detailed in that one place. And guess what? You're taking the place. It's almost like Michael Myers with Halloween. You're kind of seeing through Shockwave's eyes as he's approaching this guy from behind. And it's making your eye do the thing that Shockwave's doing. He's slowly creeping up behind this guy who's sitting at the monitor bank. And you know why he's going for it, because that's the monitor bank. That's the security guard. That's where I need to be. It's making the eye do what the eye is supposed to do to tell a story.
Well, and the fascinating thing is, you know, like you said, kind of a rookie mistake sort of thing. Like a lot of inkers, you'll see a progression across an issue where the inks get looser towards the end, or they don't spend as much time in the detail. That's not the case here with Gary Martin. I mean, mean, you go to the last few pages or anywhere in between, and he never takes shortcuts. The whole issue through, he's doing an incredible amount of work. So it's not like he spent too much time on the first few pages and not enough on the last. He really found a way to make it all work. Maybe he didn't sleep for a month. I don't know. But it just looks astonishing.
Well, again, it's both of them, too, because, I mean, he's laying down lines on what Cullen's drew.
True.
But, again, he's not doing a Vinnie Coletta on him. It's like, okay, you put that line there. I'm going to keep that line. I'm going to make it even better. And they in the Alan Gold editorial at the back of the book, he talks about how Paris saw what Martin had done with his pages, and he's ecstatic, and he's, like, hopping around like Blue Devil himself and making copies so he can show it to other people. Yeah, yeah, you want somebody who's going to value your work as much or more than you value it yourself. And it shows. You can't miss the enthusiasm from both these creators on this page.
Well, since we're talking about art anyway, I'll mention some of my favorite things about the art. I love, love, love the acrobatic after images in this issue. And they did it several times. Again, where Blue Devil's like doing a big acrobatic motion. You get the less definite and more or less opacity version of him doing like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, 10 moves to the final version where he's landing. My favorite's probably on page 18 where he does the one around the lamppost and actually bends the lamppost as he's swinging around it. It just looks fantastic.
I just did a count. There's something like 22 figures here.
Is there really?
You know,
oh, wow.
And he's not, it's not like he necessarily has to draw them in every single element of detail. Obviously, you're just getting a sense of them, but he still drew like almost 25 Blue Devils for one panel.
Wow.
That's a commitment, but also it gets you excited for this character. It's like, yeah, look at what this guy does. It's so cool the way he's bouncing around. And again, because it's Blue Devil, because he has all these enhancements, you can believe him doing all this crazy stuff. Was like, yeah, he can do that. This is a really impressive character. This is somebody to watch.
It's such a good panel. And yeah, they had a lot of fun with it. Now, there's also a ton of fun Easter eggs in here. I don't know how many of you caught. I caught a bunch of these. And you maybe looked at my notes and saw them all. I don't know. But like in the beginning, the Star Labs security guard is reading a newspaper. And on it, on the back side of the newspaper, it says Terry Austin sought. Like he's a criminal or something, which is hilarious because obviously I got to assume that was Gary Martin doing that, having a little bit of fun, you know, inkers picking a joke with another inker.
Actually, it might be that Paris Cullens was calling out who he wanted to ink his pages, and then Gary Martin made him stop asking for Terry Austin all of a sudden.
Could be. Then, and this is something I just noticed late last night. On page 6, the muggers, there's these three muggers that are mugging somebody, mugging this couple. I didn't realize it until, I don't know, it just clicked. They're the Three Stooges. It's Mo, Larry, and Curly, based on the way they look and their haircuts and everything.
I didn't catch it at the time, but as you were preparing to tell me that, it's like, oh yeah, they're the Three Stooges, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly right. Then on page 7, I will share some of the stuff, by the way, on social media so you see some of these. There's a nice scene where Dan's walking down the street and he's in the village, I guess is where whatever the village is in Metropolis. And there's all these little townhouses and stuff like that. And then like there's a guy dropping his groceries because he's so wowed by Blue Devil. But the roof line of one of those buildings is Doctor Strange's. That's Doctor Strange's window.
Nice.
So very cool. And then this one's not, I don't know if this is an art nod or overall, but, and I can't believe I never picked up on this until this read, but Dan goes to a bar at one point to commiserate with his friend, the bartender, and they're chatting and stuff like that. And it's right there. I should have got it. It's Cheers. Cause it's called Sam's Place. The bartender's named Sam McDowell rather than Sam Malone. On the wall, there is a giant framed picture of a baseball pitcher. And then there's a blonde waitress. We only see her from the back, but, you know, looks a lot, the way she's dressed, she looks a lot like Diane. So clearly echoes of Cheers going on here. So a little something for Ryan Daly there.
Yeah, that's one. I didn't go as deep into the details as you did, but it was like, is this a Cheers thing? And then I kept reading.
Yeah. So those are just the Easter eggs. So let's talk about, so if I recall correctly, you said you didn't have issue number 1 originally, but issue number 2 was the earliest issue you had. So do you have any personal history with this particular issue in that regard?
I do have personal history, but not what I thought when we discussed it last time.
Okay. Well, then make it up.
Having reread the book, what I'm reminded is that, no, I did not have this book anywhere near the time when it came out. I think one of two things happened. Either one, it was in a grocery sack of comics that a buddy of mine got that he brought to a sleepover at my apartment, and we went through them all, and a lot of that, you know, it's just like a lot of it was DC stuff from this time period. So it's very likely that was my first opportunity to read through this one. But the more I thought about it, the more I'm thinking that what it actually was about a year before that in 87, the first actual comic shop shop that I had within walking distance of my home. I think I pulled this out of the back issue bins and bought it as a back issue. So it would have been one of the very first back issues I ever bought. I think I bought a few at like flea markets and stuff, but actually the process by which we've accepted we should get comic books as proper collectors, where you go to a comic shop with a register and windows and posters and all that kind of good stuff, and walk through the doors and sleeping through their boxes and the proper cardboard boxes, white cardboard boxes, and pull a back issue out. I think this is one of the first back issues I ever bought.
Okay. All right. We'll take that as acceptable. That's fair. I was buying them just from the convenience store at this point. This was years before I got into a comic book shop. I was just going up to what we called the Sing store. I'd ride my little bike up there. I'd be like, oh, I got to get my new Blue Devil. So I was happy to pick it up however I could.
So remind me, what was the Secret Wars that paralleled this issue? Because Secret Wars was out by this point, right? You started collecting with Secret Wars.
Yeah, good point.
And so how far along was it?
So what you guys didn't hear was me Googling this, because I don't know it off the top of my head. So this issue was on the stands the same time as Marvel Super Heroes Secret Wars issue number 4. So I went right from collecting Secret Wars number 2. Then I guess the next month, I decided I was a comic collector within 30 days, and that's when I bought Blue Devil number 1. So dang. All right. So yeah, number 4 was the issue. This is the one where Hulk's holding up the mountain.
And again, weird little synergy here. That was the second issue of Secret Wars I got, because Secret Wars was a thing I was hearing about. You know, we didn't have proper, news. We didn't have the internet. So just reading Marvel comic books and hearing buzz about what this thing was. And then I see Secret Wars number 1 for some incredible price, like $12 at a flea market. I can't pay that to like $6. Good Lord. That's how many comics did I buy for $6? So the first issue I bought was 3. And I think I might have even paid like a slight premium for that at the flea market. And then the first one I ever bought off the newsstand at the 7-Eleven was number 4. So I'm kind of right there with you, sort of, kind of.
All right. Fair enough. So let's talk about the issue itself then. So what'd you think of the story?
Are we done talking about everything else? Because I'm trying to hold back on that particular aspect a little bit longer, kind of hold on to the joy a little bit more.
Uh-oh. Are you about to be mean?
isn't it odd that Shockwave spares the security guard? I know it's a funny beat, but like, he doesn't really seem like the kind of guy who'd be like, is it a situation where you're cool with me, I'm cool with you, and until people start drawing guns that he starts getting mean with people? Because I mean, he could have just smashed that guy, so he's not a complete jerk, right?
No, I think Shockwave falls in the category of like the Flash rogues of a crook, you know, like, because he goes there, he smashes into the place, right? And there's no reason to take out the security guard, because the security guard told him what he wanted to know. And then he gets over there, and now they pull the guns on him. So he didn't kill him. He just stomps him and knocks him over. So I think he falls in the realm of crook, where he's not going to take someone down if he doesn't have to.
Well, he laughs as H-A-R, har, 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 automatically disqualifying for high IQ status.
Right.
So the question is, was he too dumb to realize that he should take out the security guard that's going to alert everybody that he's there? Or does he think it's going to be funny when the guy realizes what happened and he's doing it for the gag, and that's literally why he's laughing, is because like he probably played a prank on the security guard, because it doesn't matter if he calls people. Or do you think he's just too dumb to realize that he should have taken the guy out? What do you think?
I think he was trying to pick a fight, because I mean, he specifically tells the security guard to tell them to get ready for him. So I think he probably wanted the fight. He thought it'd be fun because he knows that bullets are going to bounce off of him and he's going to be able to, you know, do that stomping motion and knock them all over.
And again, that spread where you've got all those little guns and stuff and all that little intricate machinery. This is one area where I do wish that the colorist had done a little bit more separation with this, so you could see more of that detailing. Like, everybody else was putting in all this work and the colorist was like, I'm just going to make everything a shade of green.
Oh, yeah. This part's green. This part's blue. There it is. Yeah.
But the guy's got M16s and like just so much cool detailing there that I wish that had been highlighted a little bit more.
Yeah, I can see that. But then sometimes it gets to the point where your eye's not going to the right place anymore, because there's so much to look at. Like, I don't have a problem with the blanket background coloring when it's interesting to look at, but you want the eye to go to a certain place. And here, you want your eye to go to Shockwave. You want to see him stomping and maybe notice the security guards falling down in the background. You don't want to see all those cool, not quite Kirby tech, but you know, whatever the crazy tech is on the ceiling. Yeah, you're not really supposed to be looking at that.
So the next page, the story title is Get Me Out of Here, seemingly by default. Mm-hmm. It seems like somebody decided, oh, wait, we forgot to give this book a title. We're just going to have whatever Dan's screaming at this moment be our title. But man, I love me some Todd Klein, and he really made that balloon work.
Oh, yeah.
And just, you know, it really shouldn't be the story title, but if it's got to be, fine, I'll go with it because it just looks that good.
It looks fantastic. And, it, you know, I can't tell whether it's supposed to be flames maybe, or is it supposed to be, you know, demonic or whatever, but it looks great.
You didn't mention, but when Blue Devil's in the village, there's also a whole bunch of movie gags in there that people can look at the book and check out. Then on the following page, after he does the acrobatic bit, he lands. And we all know the superhero landing. They make fun of it in the Deadpool movie. Blue Devil doesn't do that. You know, he hasn't been trained in the superhero landing stance.
Oh, the three-point landing?
The Iron Man, the three-point landing, the Spider-Man landing, yeah. So he kind of, his legs are extra akimbo, and he's kind of swaying to the side a little bit. And it's just so cool because it's like, he's not trying. He's just got that you know, I couldn't care less kind of, hey, you're going to stop this mugging now, right? It reminds me of like Michael Madsen and Reservoir Dogs, where it's just like this effortless, uh-oh, kind of moment where he's just like, I'm not here to impress you. You're going to do what I want you to do now. And he's not doing anything special. There's no effort. That's what I love about it. He just lands and you're like, oh, this is happening, huh?
Oh, I like it even better. Go forward two panels where he's having a conversation with the victims, this elderly couple that were getting mugged, where he is just casually talking about no effort. He is slamming one of the muggers up against the wall as an afterthought. He's not even trying. He's like, blam, knocking the guy over there. And I love the bit where the lady's like, are you Superman? Without missing a beat, Danny's like, yes, ma'am, that's who I am. Just, I genuinely laughed out loud at that, and I still laugh out loud at that.
I do appreciate Dan's lack of ego. You know, I think that's an important part of who this guy is.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Middle panel where he's looking at the Nibiru's pinball game that never gets developed. I just really dig the way that they do the horns. Like we talk about how Paris Cullins is just the guy who came up with these horns, and he's like the one guy who can draw these horns. It's like that George Perez costume designing thing. And it's not even the way he normally does it. It's a solid black, but there's something about the angle of it. It's almost like an abstraction of his normal horns, but it still gives you that sense of it protruding a correct distance from the face and then jutting upward. And it just looks freaking cool.
And we've seen with so many other artists that it's really hard to draw these horns right. It's very challenging. So nod to them. Now, I want to talk about that Nebros thing. So like, so he sees a pinball machine or maybe it's a video game. I think it's a pinball machine. And you see like essentially the Nebros image, and it says the demon on there. And I really thought that was going to be a plot point. Like I thought it would go somewhere. Like they were going to say, like, I don't know, there's like a race memory where we all remember Nebros or something or whatever innately. I don't know. Or maybe an alien Geiger ripoff. I don't know. But it's sort of weird that it's there and that is never addressed again. I get that it's to give you the flashback of Nebros, but I don't know. It just sticks out to me as like I felt like that was going to do something.
Yeah. And what's cool about something like that is, especially because it's an early issue, you could always go back.
Sure.
Like, so you know, Conan Michigan have talked about going back to this character at some point in time. We've had these weird things where they'll let people who haven't touched the book in 30 years do their, like, you know, the legend of Blue Devil or whatever, you know. Gary Conway did a bunch of that stuff. Marvel keeps doing it with their X-Books. It's like, it's still there, guys. You can still do something with that. And it's early enough in the run where it's not going to be weird. It's not like when they went back and tried to tell us who the Hobgoblin was and there's some supporting character that hadn't been seen in decades. It's like, oh, you can do something with that if you want to. It's still there.
I do wonder about that and why Blue Devil, other than Shadow Pack, hasn't really been that explored. I wonder if DC's just worried about a lawsuit from Duke University or something. I don't know. Like, it seems strange that they haven't done more with the IP. I mean, I guess they did put him in the Swamp Thing show, so maybe I'm just talking around myself, but I guess I feel like he should be a bigger deal. Maybe he's just not a popular enough character.
This is, I think, again, I have this experience with the Atom, is they had those, was it Filmation who did the little 6-minute DC cartoons?
Something like that, yeah. 60s?
Yeah. And so because the Atom was part of that rotation, in my mind, it's like, oh, well, this is one of the big iconic characters. He's got his own cartoon, right? And I don't realize, like, I think they made 3 episodes of the Atom segment specifically. So literally, like, not even a full single episode of a cartoon with this character. Mm-hmm. But because he was associated with Superman and Aquaman and the Justice League and the Teen Titans, Hawkman, you know, I think that these guys are all on equal level. But again, they produced only a few episodes of each one of those and just, you know, slotted them in different rotations. Because I watch him over and over again, I'm thinking that he's a bigger deal than he is. We love Blue Devil. We've loved Blue Devil for decades. We bought all these comic books. We know that there are other people like us who love this character. That doesn't mean he's a commercial juggernaut. It doesn't mean that he's like just raring for exploitation. And also, in part two, I think, is because they own this character lock stock. They already did the participation, because that's what kept us from getting the Showcase Presents edition, is because they were going to have to actually pay some money to the people because they owed them that as part of their creator contracts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we know that's in place. But otherwise, DC owns this. So they can do whatever they want to with this property. So it's not one of these situations where they have to keep renewing it and getting it out there for people to make sure they hold their copyrights. Like, I think one of the things is interesting with the Charlton characters, technically, they weren't copyrighted correctly. Technically, they're in the public domain. And I think that's one of the reasons why they've been altered so much and so many times over the years, so to make sure that, well, you can't do this with Captain Atom, you can't do this with Blue Beetle, where Blue Devil, they don't have to worry about it. They just own this. Mm-hmm. So they don't have the maintenance problem that they have with some of the things they've acquired that once belonged to somebody else who didn't maintain them the way that DC maintains their property.
No, that's fair.
Also, it doesn't help that DC keeps not realizing what their property is and doing stuff with it that isn't really correct for the property. Like, again, the Swamp Thing run.
Or that Black and Blue story they tried to do where they paired up Black. God. I mean, the concept of pairing Black Lightning and Blue Devil together is great. It just wasn't a good story they told. That was the problem. They completely redid Blue Devil into something that was completely unrecognizable.
Well, what's funny to me, too, is going through this issue, I hadn't forgotten. I knew that a lot of the early stuff was related to Metropolis because it looms large in my mind, particularly the next issue. But we'll get more into that. But what it got me thinking about is at one point in time, Blue Devil is based, or should I, more specifically, Dan Cassidy was based in Metropolis.
Mm-hmm.
And then not too many years later, and they play a little bit of that too. Obviously, Superman's shadow is cast over Blue Devil early in the run, right? And then later on, Booster Gold gets to start around Metropolis, and they make a big deal about him, you know, having interactions with the Man of Steel. Imagine if the Blue and Gold had been Blue Devil and Booster Gold instead of Blue Beetle. That could have been an interesting combo there as well.
That would have been such a joy. It would have been so much fun. Because, I mean, Blue Beetle and Blue Devil have a lot of similarities anyway. You know, the tinkering with gizmos and the acrobatics and all that.
Paris Cullens.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It absolutely could have worked. And it just, I wouldn't take away Ted Kord and everything we love about him. I wouldn't want to do that, but it could have been fantastic. It really would have been great. And, you know, so some of that you talk about the overshadowed by Superman. I think really what it is they're trying to ride the Superman coattail. So get Superman readers to read this is the way they're doing it. I do like how they brought in like Dr. Jeanette Clyburn and the Super Kryptonite in this one. It ties into the DC universe. And of course, Jeanette Clyburn makes a fantastic supporting cast member always. She, you know, from, I think, used to see her a lot in DC Comics Presents, as I recall. And of course, my memory is she's kind of named for the DC Comics publisher at the time. Jeanette Kahn was kind of supposed to be a stand-in for that. And, you know, a gorgeous redhead in a lab coat. Sure. I'm fine with that. No problem. Anytime.
That and Jeanette Kahn is still one of my favorite people in the history of comics. And she's one of those people that, like, there are people that I love in spite of their reputations, in spite of some of the dirty dealings they did. It's like, I still love you, you know, despite. And with Jeanette Kahn, it's like, I never really hear a bad story about
her. Right.
It's like she just seemed like a square dealing person and somebody who's just committed to creators and committed to doing good comic books and committed to doing good, period, you know? And so having her have a tribute in the comics is great. I want to point out too, though, I'm sure part of it is Blue Devil and this being a gateway character for me into the DC Comics universe, but I always had a real affection for Star Labs. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big believer. I like it when Marvels and DC DCs. And it just makes sense to me. Like, Marvel has all these evil high-tech organizations, and that just seems to suit them. Where it makes sense to me that DC would have a benevolent, positive, and I know Star Labs has gotten up to some shady stuff on occasion, but for the most part, we know Star Labs is a place where the heroes go to get the technical support they need. You know, if you're stuck in your suit, if your cybernetic parts aren't working correctly, you can always go to Star Labs. And for a long time there, it seemed like Star Labs wasn't a thing anymore. Like, people weren't paying attention to it in the comics. And if nothing else, I love that the Flash TV show made Star Labs a thing that everybody knows now. And if you don't have Star Labs in your DC movies or your DC expanded universe stuff, it feels like there's a loss there. I love it when I see people walk around in things like Stark Industries shirts and Star Labs shirts.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes it more real for me because it's like it's an actual company or it's like it's a real thing in our world. And because it was so tied into two of the books that were foundational for me as a DC fan, Blue Devil and Teen Titans, it just gives me joy to A, see them in this comic book, and to see that that's still a thing in our world, in our fandom.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, the fact that it's such a big thing nowadays as well, you're right. Because, I mean, it sort of transcends all of the DC properties, whereas something might be pigeonholed to a Batman story or a Superman story or whatever, Star Labs can be through all of it. Yeah, and it's a nice connective tissue that everyone relates to DC. Yeah, that's fantastic. And yeah, you do see people wearing Star Labs sweatshirts and stuff like that on the street. And they're like, oh my gosh, we live in that kind of world now. That's crazy. And by the way, a minute ago, I mentioned Jeanette Kahn, Dr.
Jeanette Clyburn.
Clyburn as being a redhead. And I just realized in this comic, she's actually got blonde hair. So
yeah, and doesn't she have like brownish or strawberry blonde hair in the Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, Who's Who entry?
I thought it was straight red, but you know,
was it? Okay.
I don't know. I would have
I defer to the Who's Who podcast guru. So if that's what you say, I believe you.
Or maybe someone who has a very specific interest in redheads. That could be it too.
Yeah, that could be too.
So speaking of Metropolis, two other things. You know, you get the nice subplot dangling about Jeanette Clyburn, you know, with the super kryptonite, and where she's thinking like, I hope Superman never finds out about the super kryptonite, which is great. I love that they're dangling that out there. And of course it pays off very soon. And then there's a bit in here where there's a fountain in a park being destroyed, and Blue Devil just starts spouting out history, saying that the fountain was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, which I then had to Google because I don't know enough about history. And he turns out to be known as the father of landscape architecture in the United States. He is famous for co-designing a bunch of urban parks. So look at that. Blue Devil, 40 years later, still educational.
And see, you dig that too, because you know the creators are real for that. Like nowadays, it's so easy to fake that you know about stuff like this. You can Google, well, who's a famous person who did such and such. The fact that you were able to prove this as easily as you could through Wikipedia or what have you shows how much easier it is. But you were for real in the 80s because you were either interested in architecture and civil design and things like that, or you had a pretty awesome encyclopedia set accessible to you. You were at the public library checking this stuff out. You had to dig for that. So that's some Dewey Decimal kung fu and props for that.
No, they had to know that. That's it. That's just too random to have have gone and looked up. Someone must have known that this guy was known for these kind of fountains or something or parks.
Well, and you look, Paris Cullens does some really kick it butt architecture. So maybe he has a background that I don't know about in this area. Because he look at these buildings, man. Like, he's for real with this stuff.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Definitely. And then, let's see, other stuff that I enjoy in the issue is this whole overarching thing about Danny, you know, being stuck in the suit, being a reluctant hero, all this kind of stuff. Like, you know, it's fun that every time he goes in public, I mean, if he goes to the grocery store, you know, he's going to piss off the Werner Brothers promotional strategy, which is great. But I love him as the reluctant hero because at some point, you think your guy's going to turn the corner and become an active superhero. But here, he has no intention of that. You know, Shockwave destroys his brownstone. He's still not in it. Then Shockwave punches him. That's what it takes Danny to get involved. And then later on in the fight, you know, he does sort of come around when he's like, all right, he's already been fighting him. And now he realizes he's got to stop this super kryptonite. Otherwise, Superman's in danger. And Superman's like mom in America and apple pie and all that. And so he realizes he's got to step up and do that. But I still love him in the reluctant hero role where he just wants to be a guy.
Well, and I know you had the same moment I did. You're reading the book and you're like, wait, he owns a brownstone? He took his life savings and he bought a brownstone and he's going to like have tenants and stuff? They're like, well, I don't remember any of this stuff. Oh, because it's going to collapse in a few pages. I don't know this. But what's interesting to me is during that sequence, he's looking out the window. He's talking with Marlo on the phone and like, what's the racket? Oh, there's a supervillain trumping around and causing problems. And so at first you're like, well, you're Blue Devil. Why aren't you down there doing something about it? Like, you have a civic responsibility. It's almost like he's Spider-Man not catching the box off thief. Right. And so at first you're judging him. And then you think about it. It's like, wait a second. If this guy lives in Metropolis, stuff like this happens all the time.
Right.
And he's used to being a regular human being there just because he's got this suit. And yeah, he does hop around. And yeah, he stopped mugging and stuff. But you figure it has to be a conscious act on his part. He isn't necessarily by default like, oh, there's a problem. I need to jump down there and start dealing with it. Also, let's be honest. It's one thing when he knows he's more powerful than a bunch of hoods who've just got some knives and stuff. And again, they look like the Three Stooges. So that probably doesn't help their intimidation factor. When you've got an actual full-blown supervillain who's armored and smashing cars and stuff, your first response is probably, I need to get away from this. This is dangerous. He never claimed to be a hero. He's done a little bit of heroism, but it's like he has to think about it. Like, it's not natural to him yet. And it's not that he's shirking his responsibility. He doesn't realize that he has that responsibility yet. He doesn't necessarily see this as a gift for him. It's still a curse. And again, he's like, oh my God, my house. But another thing that's important is that Shockwave collapses the brownstone. And then Blue Devil is still like gathering himself because he's like, whoa, whoa, what just happened? And then he's perceived as a superhero. He's done no act toward Shockwave. He's done nothing to announce you need to stop this, or hey, even he didn't even really talk about you took down my brownstone. And you got to be honest, it's probably kind of loud. There's a lot of stuff going on at this point. There's no guarantee that Shockwave heard a word that the guy said. He might be mumbling to himself because he's still gathering himself. It isn't until he A, starts getting beat on, where it's like he's forced into it, not because he wants to be a hero, but because he literally like, oh, this guy's going to beat my butt. I need to stand up for myself, you know? And he doesn't know what he can do against this guy yet. Cause again, he's been a superhero for issue number two now, right? He doesn't know what he can do. And he doesn't necessarily know that he has a responsibility because he still doesn't see that in himself. He doesn't recognize he's not Spider-Man yet. You know, he's still not there yet. He's playing with it some, but it's just not a natural instinct for him. And I hesitate to judge him for not going right into dun-da-da-da mode. But also it's cool when he does rush at Shockwave and you're really not thinking that the guy is going to be able to do something to this guy, or it's going to be more of like a Daredevil versus Hulk kind of situation. But no, he sends Shockwave flying. And I think as the reader, I'm as surprised as Dan is, because I don't know that he can do that yet. He doesn't know that he can do that yet. And we're both pretty impressed with him as a result.
And artistically, it looks great. The way it's not even in a panel. It's like in between panels where Shockwave's just flying horizontally right to left across the page, which just looks great too.
And it's a pretty nifty panel because guess what? They used it as a cover.
Oh, that's right. Well, okay. So before we do that, I do want to mention something that just kind of, I guess I no-prized this just now. You got me thinking about Danny not getting involved. Well, you know, if you no-prize this and really think about it, you know, Danny is a professional stuntman. So therefore, he's used to working on the set, a film set, even a schlocky production like Blue Devil, where their people have jobs. The pyrotechnic guys have their job. You know, the special effects, the people have their job. The stunt people have their job. They're professionals. They know all the safety things involved. They know the right way to do stuff. And your job as a professional is to respect the other person, to do their job and get out of their way. And in this kind of case, you could apply the same logic where Dan's like, okay, the cops are handling this. That's what they're trained for. That's their job. I don't need to get in their way until it becomes incredibly personal in that his own property is destroyed and he gets knocked around. So again, that's not on the page. That's me extrapolating something, but it kind of works.
Well, and also, even as a stuntman, you don't just hop in the car and jump the ramp. You're discussing it. You're mm-hmm. doing the physics on it. You're figuring out, do I need some kind of a boost for this? If you're having a fight, well, first you train to be, you know, competent in what moves you're supposed to be doing. Then you get with another person and it's a dance where you're choreographing what exactly you're going to do. You don't just run up and start punching people. So this isn't, again, it's not that he's not physically capable of doing stuff, but it's not a natural instinct for him to just run out and start having a fight with somebody. They usually plan this stuff out.
Well, Danny even makes reference to his boxing coach. Because he even says he has a boxing coach in the issue, which sort of ties into that too. Again, they're trained; they choreograph all this stuff. Yeah. All right, so you've been dancing around this for a while now.
Oh, and I'm not done yet. So, another thing I want to mention. By the way, were you going to talk about the cover yet, or you want to hold off?
Okay. So, page 13. There's a great panel. This is right before Danny punches Shockwave, which we talked about, and sends him across the room. Danny is running at Shockwave, and Shockwave's running at him. It's a great, you know, like two face to face sort thing, and it got repurposed for the cover of a comic in the United Kingdom. It was called Heroes, number 8. Someone referenced this to us in a previous episode, either on social media or whatever, I don't remember. So really, we're just following up on their comment, but they repurposed that panel, recolored it, took off the word balloons, and it has that, and it says, Blue Devil has a head-to-head with Shockwave, and features also Batwoman and Dream Girl. But yeah, Heroes, issue number 8, and it's repurposing that panel. Kind of cool.
It is funny, though, because you know they did that so they would have room to advertise Batwoman and Dream Girl of the Legion and all the other features they got, put Batman's little head in the corner. But man, the cover to Blue Devil number 2 is really good. So maybe that wasn't the call.
Yeah. Martin Gray, you know, this does say London Editions Magazine. So I got to ask, you know, what made you choose to do this if you had anything to do with this decision?
And the page before that, when Danny's coming to the realization that he's going to have to get into a fight, one thing that I think gets lost as the series progresses is I love how expressive Danny is. It would be easy to make him like a dark, spooky guy with slits for eyes and all that kind of stuff. But what I dig, he's got gigantic eyebrows. Because again, this is like darkness from legend. This is something that an artist has crafted. This isn't a human face. This is him crafting an image that's supposed to be for a horror movie. So he's got these gigantic eyebrows that are arched, and he's got these big expressive eyes with a red tinge to them. And it's so cool because they're clearly human eyes. It didn't do any weird thing like snakes or cats or anything else. It doesn't fill out the entire orb. It's just red at the pupils. But that little bit of red really pops. But also the humanity, since the rest of the eye looks like a human eye, it's like you know that there's a human behind the mask too. It feels like it's a dude wearing contacts before he gets zapped by Nibiru's, right? And the fact that he's got such a big face and he's got these big pointy ears, these elven ears, which shouldn't work, but because Paris Cullins is drawing it, and this is a big fantastic world, it does. Getting back to the whole manga thing, big expressive faces, which is not something you always have in the superhero comics, because a lot of times they make them very contained or they try to make them super realistic. And one of the things I love about this character is that he is allowed to be expressive in a way that a lot of superheroes aren't. Mm-hmm. Because he's not trying to fit a superhero ideal. He's trying to fit a ideal of this supernatural, fun, comedic character.
And I think I don't know this for a fact, but I bet if we were to talk to Paris, I bet he would say he was influenced by a lot of manga, because there is that sort of essence, especially as he gets into like the Blue Beetle issues. Once you start drawing that, everyone's eyes are huge. You know, everybody's eyes are huge in that one. And it's funny. You mentioned all the stuff about the mask for Blue Devil. In my mind, I immediately made the leap, even when I was a kid, to now, like, Blue Devil's face, I never even think of it as a mask. It's Danny's face to me. That is what Danny looks like to me now, is the Blue Devil face. I never even think about it being a mask. I think about it just, that's his face, that's his eyes, that's his mouth, all of that.
Well, and I do wonder, too, because he does look more sinister in the earlier issues. Maybe the merging of the human and the construct has made more of Danny manifest in the face. Now, I think that'd be a continuity issue for the movie, but, I mean, I'll no-prize it if you'd like.
Okay. All right, Frank, are you done dancing?
Let's see. I'm just double-checking to make sure I didn't miss anything. I do want to point out that there's the upshot on page 15, where it just looks really nice. It's just like an upward shot looking up his nose, kind of a Gil Kane thing. And he's got his little pointy goatee thingy or whatever you call that, kind of a Fu Manchu-y kind of thing. He just looks cool. I love that shot.
And I love the big earring. The big hoop earring looks great. There's even got a glint in the sun there. Yeah.
And again, you got the kind of buccaneer swashbucklery kind of thing going on there. So I dig that.
Yeah, I should mention also, last episode, I talked about the powers just on display. Because, you know, the question is, how many of Danny's powers does he continue to display as he goes on? And in this issue, he does use the giant flashbulb effect where his whole body flashes, and he used the explosive bubbles again too. So he is using a lot of his powers early on. It'll be interesting to see if he continues to use those as time goes by, because I don't remember him using the explosive bubbles for very long, and I don't remember him using the flash for very long, but I could be wrong.
I definitely the bubbles and the flash, I want to say he uses that up to around the time he first runs in the Trickster. I haven't checked. That's just going from memory. But I think within that first year or so, those just sort of fade away. Like, those aren't the powers that they felt worked for the character or something, because they just stopped using them after a while.
Well, and a lot of times, too. I mean, it's sort of like Justice League International. A lot of times, the Blue Devil issue is not about saving the world. It's about what he does around the House of Weirdness, or what he's doing, you know, hanging out with Sharon, or, you know, trying to go on a date or whatever. So a lot of times, it's not about the superheroics. It's about just whatever's going on in his life.
So I mentioned earlier being a patron of Siskoid's Who's Editing. And the whole thing with that was, as a commentator on that podcast, I would try to keep up with what Siskoid was doing and actually continue it month to month. And one of the fake books I came up with was a revival of Blue Devil. Mm-hmm. And so for about 10 months or so, I was writing my own blurbs for a fake Blue Devil comic book that only existed in my mind.
Yes.
And it brought me great joy. I just loved writing Blue Devil stuff, even if it's a little blurb, but just thinking about how to make this work. And like almost every issue of Who's Who has a stray Flash villain, which who just works really well with Blue Devil. They seem to have a parody. They're both, I don't know, kind of like, I'm not saying working class, but it's like, you know, Barry Allen went to a job every day and he checked into the job, and the job was somewhat similar to what he did as a superhero. And there's some kind of crossover with that. And so there's a little bit of like a blue collar, I'm just going in here and fight these villains. And these villains, all they're doing is robbing banks and stuff. They're not crazy people. They're not trying to change society or kill dozens. They just want money. You know, and Blue Devil's kind of in that same sort of place. So it just works well to have Flash villains and stuff. And so doing those little blurs month to month, I loved it. And part of what I loved about it is because it just made sense to me to keep leaning on the Hollywood angle. Like, okay, we're trying to make this Blue Devil movie and all these stupid Flash villains and all this stuff keeps getting in the way. And we're just month to month, we're trying to get our movie done. And then at the end, it's like, okay, now I'm trying to edit the movie in time for the release. And it's all about the Hollywood stuff.
Okay.
And so I'm reading Blue Devil number 2, and I've read it a few times over the years because, again, I bought it a long time ago. It's a fine issue. It's got really great artwork. Yeah, I love the character. I enjoy the storytelling and everything else. But also looking at it objectively, looking at it with writer hat on instead of fanboy hat on, what are they doing here? And what I get back to is, like, right now I'm working on my Micronauts podcast, and I'm also simultaneously working on a ROM podcast. And so I'm reading both books parallel to each other, one for one, two for two. And Micronauts is great because the first issue gives you all the setup that you need to explain who these characters are and why they're doing what they're doing. But at the end of the day, the book is called Micronauts, and the first issue really doesn't get to delve into that. And so then you get into the second issue, and that's when the Micronauts are trying to escape from the bad guys, and they come to Earth, and it turns out that the side is an action figures, and they're having to interact with a world that's much bigger than they are and fight the doggy in the backyard, the lawnmower and everything else. And it's like, yes, this is where the book is like becoming the book that it's supposed to be. This is why they're called the Micronauts. And then I go to Rom, and Rom, like the first second issue, he's bursting into what looks like a bank and stopping robbers, and the robbers are getting a hold of lasers and they're using the lasers to try to stop him from going after a dire wraith because they think it's a fellow human. And even though they're robbers, all of a sudden it's more important for them to protect their fellow humans than it is to just rob the thing that they came to rob. It's like, what are you doing? Why is this even happening? This isn't what this book is supposed to be. And so I'm having this problem with Blue Devil, because as much as I'm enjoying a lot of stuff that's going on, what does a shockwave have to do with the Blue Devil? Why am I getting introduced to some people at a bar and some doctor that Dan got taken to? There's a few panels of Marla and Gopher and everybody else. I want to be on the film set with Dan the next day after Nebros is gone and he's stuck in a suit, and I want to see him go to the doctor, and I want to see the awkward passes of Sharon. It's like she's attracted to him, but she's like also kind of repelled, and he's like self-pitying because he thinks he's a freak now and nobody will ever love him, and Wayne's maybe making inappropriate comments, and then Gopher still loves him and is like, hero, you can be a superhero now. He's like, I don't want to be a superhero. That's the story I want to read in Blue Devil number two. I don't want to read about him going to Metropolis and fighting Shakes the Ground guy. What does that have to do with the book that I've committed to with these first couple of issues? And I know they're going to go back to there. I know they're going to do the Hollywood stuff, but I want them to be doing the Hollywood stuff now. And if they're not doing the Hollywood stuff, I want Blue Devil to fight something that makes sense for a Blue Devil to be fighting, not just some random guy. So that's where I have trouble with the issue. It's fine. I think this is a pretty good issue 7. This is a pretty good issue 14. Issue 2, it kind of loses the plot. And the thing is, the artists are 100% on their game. The artists know what they're supposed to do. They are here 100%. I don't think the writers, especially because, again, what's interesting is Alan Gold has that editorial at the back where he talks about, like, the book was they'd already figured out what the book was going to be before the first issue comes out. It's like, we know better. You know the backstory. They're cutting up panels and moving stuff around because it's the very last minute they've decided to go in this different direction. And then number 2's due. So it's like, okay, what are we going to do? And it feels like they're still figuring out what this book is supposed to be, and they've lost the plot.
See, I would argue they've lost the plot that you wanted to see versus the plot they wanted to tell. And what they want to tell is the story of a reluctant hero. It's not, I mean, Hollywood's a big part of it, but that's not the core of what the Blue Devil story is to them. The core of the Blue Devil story is being stuck in the suit and being a reluctant hero. And I think this issue told that story perfectly well. Could the same story have been told in LA? Sure. But they wanted the hook of Superman so they can get to the next few issues and bring in potentially Supermaners, because they know they're going to get a bump from issue number 1, and then they're going to need a bump around issue 3, 4, 5, and that's where you get Superman, you get the Justice League, you get Zatanna. And so I think it makes perfect sense to put it in Metropolis, and again, make it about him being the reluctant hero, not about the Hollywood stuff. The Hollywood stuff can simmer in the background because it's only so interesting. I mean, when you really focus on the Hollywood stuff, that's when you start getting the Vanquisher, which is fine, but it's not some of the best material they've got. So I think they lost the plot of what you want to see, but I think they found the plot of what they wanted to tell, and I'm there for it. I am perfectly fine with it, and I think this issue has a great balance. You get about I counted it up, you get about 11 pages of fighting, which is about half the book. So you get half fighting. The other half is a lot of character development with Danny. You really get into his headspace, so I really like that. I feel like I know Danny. You get hints of some supporting characters and subplots, not a lot, but I feel like it was a well-constructed issue. So I see it completely differently than you, and both our opinions are valid, except mine's more valid because you're wrong.
Do you really think Superman was that big of a bump in 84?
They did.
They might have. I mean, the thing is, narratively it works because Superman gets us to the Justice League satellite. Spoilers. Mm-hmm. So it does make more sense for that trajectory versus like Batman. But if they really wanted the bump, well, I guess it's early enough. Is it early enough for Teen Titans? Like Teen Titans is already pretty, yeah, they're going full speed ahead. We needed that Teen Titans to show up and really get the bump there.
Sure. I mean, that would have been the dream. But I mean, Wolfman's over there probably being like, I'm doing my thing. Y'all quit trying to ride my coattails. You know, it's probably what he's thinking.
That's fair. There was a lot fewer new Titans appearances than one would have expected. Mm-hmm. He must have been pulling the reins on that. Okay, fair.
So overall, I think it's a fantastic issue. Frank enjoyed everything except for the comic. again, I mean, it sounds like you really, really enjoyed it. You just wanted to see a different plot. Is that fair to say?
I think that they did a good job for what they were doing. I just don't know if they were doing the right thing. And I will say that story-wise, it left me a little bit wanting. So it's not just me being contrary. I do think that the writers didn't quite get where I wanted them to be, but it's still fun. It's still solid. I feel like I would be more forgiving if it wasn't so early on and we weren't still trying to establish stuff, but it's still a good issue. It's still completely enjoyable. I still have the money back guarantee. If somebody doesn't want their two, I'll buy their two off of them.
So I want to take a second to talk about Shockwave for a moment here, because even though you said he's not, there's no direct connection to Blue Devil, that's okay. He doesn't have to. I mean, Batman and Joker, there's no direct connection between a guy dressed like a bat and someone who's in a playing card costume. There's no direct threads there. It doesn't have to be themed like a Mike W. Barr comic. But I think he's a great looking villain. I think the suit, as I said, the suit looks amazing under Paris and Gary. He's brutish. He's heavy. He's imposing. I mean, you really get the sense it's a heavy armor. You know, and yet the facial expressions are so expressive. And like you said, the har-har, that look, he looks like an idiot. I mean, his face makes him look like a dumbass. And I love that aspect of it. I already mentioned the colors. White and red are not that common, so it's instantly memorable.
Yeah. And what's funny, too, is it's not like we don't see heroes that have red and white in their costume, but there's always the third color. It's red, white, and blue, or it's red, white, and yellow. And yeah, he does have the little yellow seismograph thing, but really it's all about the white and the red. And that just pops. And mm-hmm. it's so spare because, again, the default color of the paper is white. So they're always wanting to find something to fill that space in instead of leaving it open. But when they do leave it open, it really gives you something. But also what's interesting about it, especially as you see them trying to adapt the suit to other media, is that we're seeing white just like, you know, Silver Surfer looks white whenever Jack Kirby draws him. But he's not white. He's silver. And so when you see that turned into silver in areas where you can make it silver, it's a whole different thing.
Right. Yeah. It looks kind of generic when they make it silver. When it's white, it actually pops because it's really more white than red. It's like white with red accents, and it's not common to see someone in a white costume. The only character, like, I think there's a character in Blue Beetle, actually, that's sort of similar, that's white with red accents. Catalyst, maybe? I can't, or...
Yeah,
or the right.
Yeah.
Or the white...
Free throw or something?
Or the white supremacist guy, White Dragon or whatever it was.
Overthrow? No, Overthrow was gray and something.
Yeah. But either way...
I don't know what you're talking about, yep. Though. Catalyst, I think, is the one you're looking for.
He looks great, and he's got the stomping power, which is great. So the thing that surprised me, I did a little bit of research on him last night. Blue Devil, for me, when I think Shockwave, it's the Blue Devil villain, right? I mean, that's how I think of him. Turns out Blue Devil only fought him twice. That's it. So he appeared in a handful of issues of Blue Devil, but he only came face-to-face in this issue, and then again in issue 12. That's it. Which is crazy. He ends up fighting Superman more often and Booster Gold more often than he did Blue Devil. He does come around eventually to fight Kid Devil in the Teen Titans series, but it's just kind of surprising.
I think what it is, it's like what I talked about before. There's nothing really tying Shockwave to the concept of Blue Devil. It's not like a Bullseye versus Daredevil, mm-hmm. where you just can see there's a yin and yang going on there. So he is clearly being introduced as a utility villain. And what I'm reminded of is, again, Booster Gold number one, where they introduced Blackguard. Mm-hmm. There's even though gold versus black, you could maybe try to do something with that, but really Blackguard just goes on to be a guy who fights other people. I think that maybe like Bolt fights Blue Devil, and then he goes on to fight Captain Atom. And then I think he fights Flash or other people at some point.
He fights some guys, everybody.
Right. So some guys are just like, you know, Vulture is a Spider-Man villain. You know, and then anybody else who fights him is Spider-Man's villain. But then there are other guys where it's just like he's everybody's. You know, everybody gets a turn with this guy. Shockwave did what he needed to do in the Blue Devil book. Then he'd go off and do something else. And I don't have a problem with that. I like that a character generated for the Blue Devil book has a life outside of it. What I don't like is they mess with the costume. And that's like the thing that makes this guy work. work, right?
Yeah, they made him blue, which is kind of weird. It looks like he's a Superman villain now in post New 52, which is kind of surprising.
Yeah, like, why, not to diminish Shockwave, but like, somebody already designed that for you. Why are you taking the time to redesign Shockwave?
Right!
There's... And especially because you're doing it badly. You're making the suit worse. The simplicity is what works. Leave it alone. Or at very minimum, you don't change the color scheme.
Right. I don't know what they were thinking about. I guess maybe they thought the blue would contrast better. Because I think that was done in Teen Titans. Maybe they thought it would contrast better with Kid Devil because he was red and that would be blue. I don't know. Either way, yeah, the classic look is absolutely the way to go with Shockwave. It just looks great.
And so you look at him on the first issue, or sorry, the second issue cover, and you open that cover up on the inside front cover. What's this? An ad for superpowers. What does one have to do with the other?
Thank you for that wonderful segue, Frank. So yeah, it's interesting that Shockwave was introduced in this issue, and very quickly he was considered for a Kenner's action figure. In fact, there's art and a prototype of the Shockwave figure. You can find images out there where they took literally two pieces of artwork from this issue, the Shockwave on the cover of issue number 2, and then the Shockwave and the big splash page. They took those and used those by this guy named Underhill, redrew them for the Shockwave sort of pitch meeting to say this could be a figure for Kenner. And then they actually made prototypes, and those pictures are out there too on the internet where you can find. And the prototype figure for Shockwave with Kenner would have been amazing. He was thick. He was chunky. Unlike all the other Kenner figures where they're like skinny minis, this dude was a big hunk of plastic and would have been an awesome, awesome addition. And the facial expression, they went all out on a kind of a Paris Cullens, like, rah, kind of face. And it really is an exceptional looking figure.
And you know what gets me, though, is why did you make a new mold for Shockwave? It's a color variant on Darkseid. You vacuum sealed Darkseid, you know, and change it, maybe change out the boots or something. You just repurpose Darkseid and save on the molds. To me, that's why would you go for Shockwave of all the characters you could produce in the line? I know things got weird there by the third series, but like, just you've got the Darkseid mold. Just, it's a repaint. Like, Darkseid is gray and dark blue. And then you're going to come out with a version that's white or silver with red accents. The job's done. Go home.
Well, I'm glad they didn't go that route, because the version they put together that would have been in production is just stunning. Again, just the level of detail where they're putting the... what do you call it? The joints and all the fingertips where they're the red lines. I don't know what else to call it. Where the joints were the metal, the seismographic thing, the facial expression, all of it just is incredible amount of detail and would have been an awesome looking action figure.
Segmentation, do you think?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
Well, and I would really, maybe they'd have to do like a Master of the Universe style plastic piece to put on top. I really do want the collar. I'm fine with a repaint on Darkseid, but you got to give me the collar. But the fact remains, neither one of our things happened anyway, so it's all figments of our imagination. We might as well go with like the three model versions they've got on the internet.
Yeah. Well, you know, and could you imagine having the Shockwave and Blue Devil action figure to play with, though?
Oh my God. Oh, the things I would have done to have had a Blue Devil action figure at that age.
Well, it would have, I mean, it really would have changed his profile. I mean, because that happens a lot with characters, is that something gets out in the public consciousness, either in the Super Friends or action figure or whatever, and it just pushes them forward on a trajectory that just hangs around forever. So Blue Devil really did unfortunately miss that opportunity.
I feel like you could kitbash that with like Martian Manhunter and Dr. Fate. I'm just picturing that. I think that could kind of work. Or maybe you'd have to use a repurpose Aquaman's trident. You know, I'm trying to save pretend Kenner from 40 years ago some money here. but I can see where you could have done it without it being, you know, breaking the bank. Because I know there's only so much, you only want to go so far on a limb for Blue Devil. There's only so much of an audience. But also, that figure would look so cool that even if you weren't a fan of superheroes or superpowers, you're looking at this dude with the horns and the trident, and you're like, I want that. Give me that. Give me the dude with the Fu Manchu. That's the action figure I want.
Well, it's also kind of interesting that both Shockwave and Blue Devil were in, at least in development, by Kenner, and they were only at that point, let's say even at the tail end of the line, they're only a year or two old at that point and already in development as an action figure by Kenner, which is pretty darn impressive. So,
did the Blue Devil have an action feature in the prototype, or did they have a prototype? Did it get past the drawing stage?
I've never seen a prototype. I've only seen the drawings. Yeah. And actually, you know, you don't see Shockwave with a, was it power action feature or whatever here either. So
he's got to stomp. You got to squeeze the arms together and he stomps. There's no other way to do this.
Could be. It looks like he's got the kryptonite container of the super kryptonite on his back. So interesting. All right. So moving on to the letters page here. It's another article by Alan Gold, because they don't have letters yet. Just some things to shout out. They do talk about how Blue Devil was a vehicle specifically to showcase Paris Cullen's talents. There's no mention of Steve Ditko, which we know the truth is they wanted to showcase Steve Ditko first, then switch to Paris. Apparently Gary Cohn and Dan Michigan, again, this is all per the article here, were tasked with writing something with heroics and a broad action tinged with supernatural, again, to showcase Paris's talents. Then it was going to appear as just a brief story in Tales of the Unexpected. So that's all it was going to be. It was like this brief story. But Len Wein saw the potential of Blue Devil. He said, make it more fun, expand this to this short story to a full 23-page story with large, memorable supporting cast. And from there, they put together that infamous prospectus or pitch that we've talked about before that Gary Cohn has shared with us. And it's an amazing pitch. Dick Giordano was so impressed with this pitch, he would like go around and show it to newcomers at DC saying, this is how you pitch ideas, which is awesome. And Alan Gold also credits, he takes credit for pairing Gary Martin with Paris Cullen. So we all owe Alan Gold a huge debt for bringing Gary Martin on board. And then there's just a quote I like to read out here. It says, by Alan Gold here, it says, all comics are supposed to be first and foremost fun. Blue Devil, however, means to be sunnier and more exuberant than many, and it will be 100% non-preachy, non-artsy, schmartsy, and never self-important. Which I think that's fair for the 31-issue run, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They never put on their vertigo britches or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, okay.
Although I do have to point out, though, that we do have the Saga of the Swamp thing by, you know, the knighted Alan Moore advertised in Blue Devil, which is definitely a weird combination. They're literally pimping the anatomy lesson, and you couldn't get further away from Blue Devil in that ad.
Well, I don't think DC knew what they had yet with that comic. I don't think they understood what the Alan Moore Swamp thing was going to be. So they were just promoting, like, hey, this is new and different, and not realizing how weird and different that was going to be for them and how it was really going to change the whole trajectory of the company, which leading to Vertigo eventually.
One more superpowers thing is, uh-huh, I'm looking at the ad for the Jack Kirby miniseries, Jack Kirby Blue Devil. Wouldn't that have been neat?
I don't know. I love Kirby. In the mid 80s though, some of his DC stuff was like, I loved his Dr. Fate. His Firestorm is super interesting to look at, but I don't love it. So I don't know how I would have felt about Blue Devil. It would have been interesting to see the blockiness. That would have been fun. But I don't know if I would have loved it or not. The only way to know would be if he drew it. So,
and it's entirely fanciful, because by this point it would have been Carmine Infantino anyway. So never mind. he'd have been fourth wave. So Carmine, no, I'm good. Never mind. Sorry.
All right, folks, now it is time to get to our Weirdness Magnet Award. This is where we're going to nominate our favorite moment from the issue. Apparently, Frank hated the whole thing, though. Whether it's a story beat or something in the art or something that made us laugh, whatever. So, Frank, what would your nomination be for the Weirdness Magnet this issue?
I think there's a really good chance that we're going to be simpatico on this. I've got two options for you. The acrobatic jumping earlier in the issue, but I'm going to go with him getting served. Because that's such a unique thing. It's such a specifically Blue Devil thing for him to get served for existing. I was aware of this because of the third issue, recapping what happens to this issue, and it's still my favorite part of the issue.
Okay. I absolutely love that part. I truly do. It is not the moment I picked, but boy, I really, really liked it. And I think it was genuinely funny, especially at the end where like the news crews are packing up and the police are packing up and they're just pretending not to see the guy out of loyalty to Blue Devil, which is just genuinely funny. But I did pick the page with the acrobatics, actually. Page 6, where it starts off. I picked the whole page, actually, where it starts off with the acrobatics that whatever you counted, like 25 after images of Blue Devil. And then where he stops the mugging. Because, again, I just had the landing. And then that part that still cracked me up where, are you Superman? Yes, ma'am. That's who I am. So that, for me, that page is the Weirdness Magnet. It sort of sums up Blue Devil with the acrobatics and the fun and the carefree attitude. Just absolutely love it. So both great moments make the issue totally worth it.
And again, we're obviously in agreement because we both stated the same ones. I do have to point out that, again, Blue Devil's our hero. And I dig that the cameraman and everybody on the street, when the lawyer's trying to serve him and ends up hung up on the hook until he says he's not going to cause any problems, because this is an X-Men situation. He's not feared and loathed or anything. They recognize he's one of us. He's a blue collar hero. We got his back. And I that's so much what I love about Blue Devil. He's one of us. He's not some high and mighty guy who's going to tell us how to live our lives. It's just when some crazy person's stomping down the street and wrecking stuff, he's going to go out there and put a stop to it, because it's just as simple as that. You need to stop that guy.
I really like this blue collar hero idea that you're pushing. I don't know that I'd really, I mean, I think I innately knew it, but I don't know that I labeled it as such now. And now I can't stop thinking about it. So I'm going to be thinking about that through every issue. All right. Well, folks, we are going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we are going to read your feedback from Blue Devil number one.
Celebrating the tradition of apes in comics, for 2024, Gorilla Grodd has transformed JL May into JL April, exploring a phylum of amazing apes, such as
Batman Annual number 23,
Wonder Woman number 170,
Kong on the Planet of the Apes, issue 1,
Angel and the Ape,
The Helmet of Fate, Detective Chimp,
Showcase number 77,
JLA versus Godzilla versus Kong,
Swamp Thing volume 2, Annual 3,
Kong Gorilla, issues 1 through 4.
With a host of podcast all-stars like
The Bat Pod,
Resurrections, an Adam Warlock and Thanos podcast,
Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast,
Dolph of Flanger,
The Quarterbin Podcast,
Coffee and Comic,
Once Upon a Geek,
Fanholes Podcast,
Married with Content with John and Maggie,
Campus Comics Cast,
and many more. Look for the hashtag JLApril2024 on social media, the podcast crossover event that doesn't monkey around.
JL April.
Damn dirty ape.
Monkey around? Really?
I'm not a cybernetic organism, but I do have an important mission. Many of you have asked for me to create a podcast. Welcome to
Terminator.
No!
Celebrating the 40th anniversary of Jim Cameron's Terminator franchise, a sibling show to Dark Horse presents Aliens. Terminator Now will cover the comic book adaptations of the dystopian future sci-fi series.
So we created this for you. If you've seen my movies, I know what you might be thinking, but don't worry. This machine is a good machine, and if it ever turns bad, I will terminate the problem.
So it's me. It's flesh and blood guests. It's text-to-audio robots. Whatever it takes.
So join us. We'll always leave you feeling better.
The show will be featured in our clean language, rolled spine podcasts, four-color feed, so you can listen to stories about murder bots and the post-nuclear apocalypse with the entire family.
Do your future self a favor. Hit the subscribe button today. Come with me if you want to live.
All right, we're back to cover Speak of the Devil, which is our version of the Blue Devil letter column, which, of course, was originally called Circuits and Sorcery, but we are covering your feedback from Blue Devil number one. And remember, folks, we are pulling your comments from the Fire & Water Podcast website, so we'll be pulling just bits and pieces of your comments to share here on the air. If you want to be included next time, leave your comments on Blue Devil number two on the Fire & Water Podcast website on this episode, and we will read it on the air. All right, Frank, you're up first.
So the first comment is from Brian Sciufo. Oh, thankfully, Jag has given me the pronunciation of Shofo, so I'll pronounce that correctly.
Shufo. Shufo.
Well, I'll pronounce it faux show. Shufo.
I am sorry, Brian. I sincerely apologize for doing this to you.
So Brian Shofo, all the comparison images show the digital versions being quite bright and harsh to look at. It reminds me of the vinyl versus digital debate. The halftone dots on the printed page are similar to crackles and pops of listening to vinyl and have a way of softening the end result. Good point. Which opens another can of digital worms. In the digital version, can the colorist listed on the splash page still be considered the colorist? Ooh, some Ship of Theseus stuff going on over here.
Well, I find that interesting, though, because really the colorists of the day knew how much the paper would eat the color. So they chose those colors knowing they would get muted. So when you look at some of these more garish colorings nowadays, because it's just the original color key, but on a surface that doesn't absorb the ink at all. It just shows the whole thing. It's not the colors they intended. So that's a very valid question, Brian. Huh, interesting. A
little tricky too, because again, I know they're going back to the color guides, and so therefore the colorist's color guides are probably truer to what the colorist's intent was than the printed comics in the original editions. But I will also agree that I don't think glossy stock, which is universal now, especially when it comes to things like omnibuses and such, I don't think it's necessarily the best way to present a lot of these comic books. And I really miss things like Baxter paper, some of those formats that we had back in the 80s. And I think part of the problem is that it is a heavier stock and you got more actual pulp in that paper, I think, because it has more weight to it. I think the glossy stuff is thinner. I think, don't they have some plastics in there or something? And you're like literally getting less paper and it's too blasted shiny. And I really wish we could get back to like Mondo format, Baxter format, some of those ones they had back in the 80s when the paper was actually felt like and smelled like paper. Because one thing I will have to say is, as much as I enjoy having these big library editions on my bookshelf, the smell's not there. It don't smell like the old school comic books, and I miss that. Your comic book binding of Blue Devil, though, is going to smell just like you expect it to smell. I'll have that. No matter what I do, you will always have me beat in the smell department.
That's so weird. I'll have newsprint and mold. It'll be a beautiful thing. Or mildew, I guess. But anyway, then we heard from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. Bucky says, have you seen the DC 13-episode Swamp Thing series? I've only seen a few episodes, but some said Blue Devil is in it. Is he? Yes, Bucky, there is a version of Blue Devil in the Swamp Thing series. It is a Dan Cassidy, former Hollywood stuntman, who is in a devil costume, but they do roll in a lot of the new 52 ideas where it's like, you know, demonic possession and a lot of craziness. So it's not our fun Blue Devil, let's put it that way, but it is a version of Blue Devil and there is some recognizable elements of it.
So I'm reading for Slobberknocker, and apparently all of the children of parents who did not love them when they were naming them. I love this comic as a kid. I read it again about 10 years ago on Comixology. Is still greatness. True that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, maybe not issue number two, but mostly other ones.
Oh my God, issue two is so good. Then we'll hear from Dr. Ange, who does the Supergirl blog comic box commentary and with the Legion of Super Bloggers. Dr. Ange says, love this episode. I must admit that I don't quite understand how Blue Devil missed me when it came out. It was 1984 in the Ange should be reading mature comics phase was just about to emerge. I wonder if I thought this might be too silly for me at the time. Funny how now all I want is quippy, silly, more classic superhero fare. But still, not quite sure since I was reading Firestorm, Legion, and other books that are within reach of what Blue Devil was doing. So I'll be listening along and might keep my eye out for the issues or read them along on the app. Well, I hope you are reading along on the app, Dr. Ange, because it's a lot of fun. And then he says, because you posted part of our thing here is the casting couch, and you asked people for their casting of Marla Bloom last time. So Dr. Ange chimes in and goes, I think Gal Gadot would be the perfect Marla based on her visual look and the need for a take action girl boss actor to fit the bill. Interesting. Your hot take on Gal Gadot is Marla?
Double Jeopardy.
Like you got to go for double points to answer that question?
No. It's like you can't get charged with the same crime twice and you don't get to play two superheroes unless you're Chris Evans.
Or Ben Affleck.
Yeah. And, hey, look, he's got the trifecta, man. He played Superman, Batman, and Daredevil.
I know. All right, you're up.
Keith G. Baker, there's a name I can get through. Sports and Comics, which is a theoretical thing that we've talked about in the previous episode. He said, great show, even with the hosts involved and me being called out personally. I'm being called out personally with that line, so even. Fan casting of Marla Bloom, my first thought went to Sarah Rafferty, who plays Donna on Suits. I think that's a good pick, don't you?
I haven't seen Suits. I looked her up. I don't know the actress. She's cute, but I don't know. I've never seen her act, so I have no idea.
Yeah. Props. I think that's an excellent call. She can play a woman comfortable being in charge and who every man wants to be in charge of them. Ooh la la.
Okay. All right.
And then I'm going straight into Siskoid of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I think he does some shows. I'm not sure which. I love Sarah Rafferty, so I can't complain. So that's two Sarah Rafferty votes. And again, if it comes down to some sort of a quorum, then I'm going to join in with the guys.
I wait till you hear my casting. So hold on. All right. Then we heard from Matt Sorois, who goes by Movie Matt Sorois, and he does the TV Movie Rewind podcast. He says, since the previous Blue Devil episode, I put together a run of the first six issues of the series. I had a blast reading them. At first, I kind of wish Blue Devil resided in a separate universe all his own, but after his adventures with Zatanna, I was glad he was able to interact with the rest of the DCU. The book reminded me of DC's Impact line that came out a few years earlier, fun comics aimed at a wide audience. Great stuff. Looking forward to finding more issues. Yeah, those Zatanna issues, besides the fact that, like, to me, Paris Cullens and Gary Martin, that is what Zatanna is supposed to look like. That version with the bug on the head, I mean, it was also incredibly sexy, very formative, just wow. That is my Zatanna right there.
Think clean thoughts, chum.
Too late.
So as I mentioned, having read Micronauts and ROM in recent memory and still in the early issues, it's got that early installment weirdness where they're going to be in the Marvel Universe, but they're not yet. And so they're still, everything's so contained. And it's a little frustrating for me because I'm already like, well, why isn't this happening because of this happening? And it's great because Blue Devil gets that out of the way. As much as I was griping about issue two, hey, look, he's already in Metropolis. Hey, look, his preview comic is already in Firestorm. I think they reference DC Heroes in the preview story in some way, like Gopher had a poster or action figure or something.
Probably something, yeah, I'm sure.
I love that Blue Devil is the hot new character find of the DC Comics universe, and he's not existing in his own separate thing. I think that's a value to the character. I think he brings something to the DC universe that isn't there already, so I'm really glad that they're already committing to him being a part of this lineup.
Yeah, me too.
So Doug Adamson writes, good to hear such in-depth coverage of this run because it has been sorely overlooked by far, far too many people. Absolutely. As for casting Marla, if it's 80s retro, which is more your angle, Shag, I'd have thought about choosing Bonnie Bedelia or Virginia Madsen. Mind you, Madsen might be too young. She is. Mary McDonnell might actually have been perfect. That's another. Bonnie Bedelia and Mary McDonnell are definitely on the same wavelength.
I'll chime in there. Bonnie Bedelia and Virginia Madsen. I mean, you just age them where you want. Don't get hung up on the years, but age them to the years you want. Those both would have been great picks, I think. I'm not on the Mary McConnell train, but yeah, Bonnie Bedelia and Virginia Madsen would have been great picks for Marla.
Whereas for me, Virginia Madsen is too much of a sex bomb. I can't see her being Marla. I think that she's got more of a subdued thing going on, so it's much easier for me to see Mary McDonnell in that position. But again, she might be a little on the young side too, you know. This, if we're talking the 80s now.
Well, no, it could be, I'm just saying, slide the scale anywhere you want. You know, you don't have to be, like, you keep trying to pigeonhole me to the 80s guy. No, I'm just finding the right actress in the right period of their life is where I'm doing. So,
no, you just have a dated frame of reference. Let's be honest.
That too. Yeah. I look on the cover of People magazine. I'm like, I don't know who any of these people are.
If it's, by the way, we've talked for so long, it's Doug Adamson. I want to reiterate. If it's now, however, for the upcoming James Gunn DCU, James Gunn, Blue Devil, that's an interesting proposition. Oof. There. I hadn't even thought about that. It depends on how old you expect Dan to be, as Marla would need to be mid-30s. I don't know if I agree with that. I would suggest she has a white streak, you know. I would suggest Katrina Law. Interesting. Okay. You know, remember her?
I had to Google her. I don't know her.
Arrow. She was Nisa Al Ghul, if I recall correctly. She was also in Spartacus, I think.
That implies I watched either.
Okay. You ever been in Nography? No. You don't want Marla, if we were aging her up a bit, to be late 40s or early 50s with an older Dan, which might be an interesting dynamic. My first and possibly only choice would be Catherine Tate. Okay. I could see that.
Hard stop for me. No way. I know. I've spoken with Catherine Tate. I've know her too well. I just, she's too much of a comedic actress. I don't see Catherine Tate. Sorry.
I can see it, but she's not my Marla.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll leave it like that. To me, Marla is someone who isn't a prototypical movie star, look more character actress who didn't get the breaks and ended up behind the camera. And I definitely see that. One of the people I had in mind, this is an issue that I have too. My frame of references were also a bit dated. There was an actress who was in a spinoff of the early Fox sitcom called Duets. And she was a real estate agent. And she's like the first person I pictured in my mind. And then I realized I don't even remember the actress's name. Nobody's going to know who I'm talking about. But I totally get, yeah, find somebody who was a supporting actress or a sitcom actress. That's really more the lane that we should be looking for. But I'll get into that more once we start talking about my pick.
All right. Up next is Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast over on the Right On Podcasting Network. Tim says, I've been looking forward to listening to this one and it didn't disappoint. Your discussion is thorough, insightful, and funny, so thanks for starting this segment within the podcast. I started Blue Devil with issue number 12, pretty late, I know, but scared up the back issues quick as I could. His look, his supporting cast, fun stories, great artwork, it all clicked for me. In fact, I remember getting that issue from Walden Books. Ah, memories. For issue number 1, it's a delight and a great launch for the series. It does everything it should do to draw new readers in, but I always struggle to find number 1s back in the day, such is my life. On reread, there's something magical about Cullen's art that still makes me smile. The energy, the acrobatics, the monster, so much to love. And he says, I like Frank's suggestion that Wayne plays the Herb Tarlick of the series. I'd also put him as the rival rather than the antagonist in competition with Dan, but not necessarily working against him. There's times when I don't like Wayne and times when I do, and it'd be great to revisit that with the series. Yeah, no, Wayne is an interesting character because, yeah, he is the rival without being an antagonist. And, the Herb Tarlick is such a great, great pick.
I'll add, too, that since I was talking about the whole blue and gold, Blue Devil, Booster Gold, if they'd brought Blue Devil into the series, sort of like Power Man and Iron Fist, where they're one character can't support their own title, so they put them together, Booster could have kind of been his Wayne in that.
Oh, yeah.
Carry on. So, yeah, just putting that out there.
Absolutely. Now, folks, again, if you want your comments read on the next episode when we cover Blue Devil, comments on issue number 2, go out to our website, firewaterpodcast.com, go to the Once Upon a Geek post for issue number 2, leave your comments there, and we will read a portion of them on the next episode. All right, it's time for the casting couch, Frank, and don't think dirty thoughts when you think that. We're talking about Marla Bloom, and you have your pick, I have my pick. Do you want to go first, or you want me to go first? This is your pick.
Well, we're following a little bit of a script here, and you've got your name first, so I figure it's your turn.
All right, so a lot of the picks there that you guys talked about were pretty good. Again, I liked the Bonnie Bedelia. I liked the Virginia Madsen. I thought those were both good ones. But for me, and I am going to a dated reference, of course, I picked Candace Bergen from Murphy Brown. So picture around season 3 or 4, the show's on all thrusters. She is take charge. She doesn't take crap from anyone. She's kind of got the power thing going on in television already there. So you kind of transport that same sort of charisma to the film industry. Candace Bergen, at the height of her powers in the, was that around 1990, would have been perfect as a Marla Bloom in my mind.
My father had a big crush on her from her 70s work, mm-hmm. and I was a fan of Murphy Brown, particularly once it hit syndication. And of course, I mourned that the soundtrack made it to where you couldn't see it any other way besides, commercial syndication. And I got my gal watching the first season because that got out on DVD, thankfully, and she was a fan too, and we really wanted to be able to continue with it. So I'm definitely a big fan of Candace Bergen. Never watched the reboot.
Oh,
never.
That bad? Okay.
It's one of the worst things ever. So don't ever do that.
But how about her as Marla? Come on.
Oh, no. I think that's a good shot. She's Kurt Russell, Candace Bergen. I'm enjoying this movie so far.
Thank you. All right. So now I peeked ahead. I kind of know where you're going here. I'm surprised because I totally expected someone from Designing Women because it's all you talk about every time Marla gets brought up. Right.
Well, again, this is me recognizing my own mortality. Is what I'm thinking about is, okay, so I'm thinking about this type of like sitcom actresses and stuff and like the older women that I had crushes on. And I keep forgetting that I'm really old. And like all these people that I'm thinking about are like not like cougars or something. They are not even they're like retirement home people.
Right.
Like they're all like way older than I think they are because I keep forgetting how old I am. And I even tried to like, okay, well, let me think about somebody who's just a little bit older than me from 20, 30 years ago. So first I'm like, oh, well, how about, let's say, Dana Delaney? She's pushing 70. Also, she was Lois Lane. I'm thinking about Diane Lane. Martha! She's already been Superman's mom, so double jeopardy. And she's also pushing 70 at this point. So it's like, I need to think about people that are like more my contemporaries because I'm the age that you would expect her to be, because even though she's got the white streak, even though you have a sense of her being an older woman, and kind of would have to be in a position of power as a producer on movies. So it's like, okay, well, who's somebody who was maybe close to my age 20 years ago that I liked and are still working today and could still be in a movie? And I also want to disqualify, like, the thing is, like, especially when you're talking about actresses over 40, a lot of these folks are only going to get, like, so many opportunities to do, like, a big blockbuster movie where they're, like, high profile and they're doing superhero stuff. And especially, when it comes to the heroines, they'll let a middle-aged guy be a superhero, and it's worked out pretty well. But when it comes to the female characters, in like early 30s is about as old as they're willing to go for a first movie. So it's like, okay, so there's some people that are just kind of, they're not going to give them an opportunity to run around in spandex. So who would be game for this kind of thing, would be fun, would be high profile enough to where you feel like you're getting value added, but like not somebody who'd be totally distracting. There was a bunch of people I thought about where it's like, we could get them, they're gettable, but like you would not be like, you'd keep going, why is that person in there? It'd be like Julia Stiles in the First Born movie where you're like, she's just working at the the monitor. She's just making a couple of phone calls. She's not actually going to do anything in this movie. So I ended up going tribute to our French-Canadian Siskoid. I cannot pronounce her name properly. Caroline DeVernis is the anglicized version of it. She is probably still best known for Wonderfalls in the early 2000s. She's somebody who I think could definitely do the sitcom-y elements of the show. She's around the same age where she still looks great. She's still absolutely desirable. She's young on in my brain. It's like she's kind of young for it, but then I'm like, okay, but if you've got like teenagers that are watching the 45-year-old in a movie, that's definitely what they would be wanting, the way that I would have wanted Barlow back when I was reading these comic books. I think that she could play the comedy, but I think she can also play the straight. I think she's somebody who is endearing in a way where she's, a lot of the time, Marla's got to be traffic manager, and she's sometimes got to be the boss lady who's kind of coming down on people, but you want to make sure that she's never in a place where you're mad at her for it. You always kind of like want to be on her side a little bit. And I think that DeVernis can bring that energy. And I think she'd look good with a white streak in her hair.
Okay. All right. I had to Google her. I see lots of pictures of her. Never seen her act, so I can't really speak to it.
You've not seen Wonderfalls?
I have not.
You must. It is fantastic. Have you watched any of Brian Fuller's shows?
We're just going to keep saying no to every question you ask me. Okay.
Let me just say, Wonderfalls, it didn't even get a full season. It's got William Sadler in it. It's got Ronan the Accuser. What's his name?
Yeah, that guy.
That guy. Yeah. It is funny. It is smart. It is weird. There's definitely like Doctor Who energy because there's a very fantastical premise to the show. I don't know if it's streaming anywhere, but seriously, you will fall in love with it. I'm shocked you've not seen it because it is such a shag show. And I know you've already told me if I recommend something to you, if anybody recommends something to you, you will ignore it. I'm telling you, you're denying yourself a predictable, guaranteed joy. And once again, if you in some way find yourself an opportunity to pick up Wonderfalls, which almost every half-price books I go to has a copy available. If you don't like it, I'll buy it off of you because mine's pretty beat up. My DVDs are pretty beat up. I'll take it off your hands. So do it for your own good because it won't take long. It's a very short series, but it's so much fun. You'll be ecstatic. You will be like, you'll go into seizures of joy. You're going to love the show so much. It is so a shag show.
Keep pushing it and you know what you're doing. You know what you're doing. If you just casually mentioned it, you would have been better off. They'd be like, oh yeah, you should check it out. Maybe. I don't know. Whatever. I don't care. And then I would have been like, oh, I got to see that now. So you know, you made a mistake. All right. So we've got some great casting there. We've got some great ideas there. Another one that just occurred to me, I wouldn't actually want her in this role, but the way you were describing the way Marla should be portrayed and older actresses, Hannah Waddingham came to mind from Ted Lasso. Because she was an incredibly powerful woman in charge on Ted Lasso. Again, I wouldn't want her because she's just too statuesque and too tall and too stunning and everything like that. But that was the kind
too
of
British.
Role. Too British. That's the kind of the role, though, that I think Marla should play. Should be that bossy, you know, kind of a bitch, but you kind of root for her, you know, kind of way. And anyway, so all right. So who are we putting on the casting couch next time?
Do something weird. Let's go with Wayne.
Wayne. All right. So the washed up soap opera actor. We're going to do Wayne. All right. I am.
And keep in mind, too, especially you being in 80s mode, Robert Downey Jr. could have pulled off Wayne at one point in time.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Interesting.
He could have brought that Kirk Lazarus energy to Wayne. That would have been kind of cool. But double jeopardy, triple jeopardy. You cannot use Robert Downey Jr. for Wayne Tarrant. Guys, I'm going to stop you now before you even try that. There's no traction on that.
I'll throw out another one that's a little too real life that my brain immediately goes to because you're making me think 80s, even though I don't have to, is John Stamos. Because, right,
oh,
you know.
I knew you were going to say that.
Because he was. Because he was a soap opera actress. You know, that's where he started, was on General Hospital. I remember him as Blackie on General Hospital before he ever did anything else.
And the fake Beach Boy. Yeah, that's Wayne Tarrant territory for sure.
So no Robert Downey Jr. and no John Stamos, folks.
Immediately disqualified.
Yep. So you're going to have to think of some other people and leave that in the comment section on the website, and we'll talk about it next time. And with that, Frank, I want to thank you on joining me for this extra long journey that I didn't think was going to be very long of discussion at all, especially for someone that hated the comic. Thank you for helping me celebrate Blue Devil. And why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you?
I'm at Rolled Spine Podcasts. If you like clean stuff along the lines of Fire and Water, then you should maybe check out my comic reader resume, where I basically do autobiography on a monthly basis via comics, movies, music, what have you. and it's a fairly short show. It's usually only about 20 minutes or so. I also on the clean feed have the Terminator podcast, which I'm sure will get a plug in this episode. And I'm currently going through the Now comics. I'm working my way toward the Dark Horse stuff. Sometimes I have guests. So far, the episode has been so packed, I really don't have room to have people come in and talk about the stuff. Plus, I'll be honest with you, nobody but me read the Now stuff anyway, so and shouldn't. You know, there definitely is a strong hate read quality to it. So, you know, but fairly positive still. And, if you like saucier stuff, you can listen to the Aliens podcast where we use a lot more profanity and I have a lot more people helping me with that one, covering the Dark Horse presents Aliens time period. We're working our way almost out of the 90s now. We're almost 40 episodes in at this point. And also, we have our legacy show, the Marvel Superheroes podcast. Upcoming episodes will include coverage of Warren Ellis's and Adi Granov's Extremis storyline from Iron Man that heavily influenced the movie. We should be talking about Captain America the Winter Soldier in the coming months. And we just finished that Daredevil retrospective, and we should do a 50-year Punisher retrospective in the near future as well.
Ooh, that sounds fun. Very cool. Awesome.
I've already watched all the movies. Pity me.
One of those is good. I'll let you at home figure out which one you might be talking about. But again, thank you, Frank, for being here. I appreciate it. And folks, while I love talking about Blue Devil, next month we're going to be tackling a different topic. And don't worry, as I said, we will get back to Blue Devil coverage in the coming months. My goal is, again, to produce 3 episodes each year on Blue Devil. Now, for next month...
Hey, we'll have a Blue Devil Christmas, apparently, based on our current scheduling. And you did have to mention Henny Waddingston, whatever the heck her name is, to remind me that one of the reasons why this episode is so late is because you just had to talk about Ted Lasso.
I did have to talk about that. I literally had to get that out of my system. So for next month, though, we are going to be joining our fellow podcast geek friends for our annual crossover. This year, instead of JL May, we're doing JL April. Get it? JL April? Yes. We're all podcasting about apes in one form or another. Here on Once Upon a Geek, I will have a guest with me to help me cover Helmet of Fate, Detective Chimp. Who will my guest be? Well, sorry, folks. We're just going to have to wait and find out. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Frank.
And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy.